type that made Shallan squirm. "I remember," Yasna said. "A nervous, desperate young woman, frantic to earn my goodwill." Shallan didn't reply. "I understand," Yasna said, "that you have enjoyed independence. What you accomplished here is remarkable, Shallan. You even seem to have earned my uncle's trust. A challenging task." "Then maybe we can just call the wardship finished, eh?" Shallan said. "I mean, I'm a full Radiant now."
"Radiant, yes," Shallan said.
"Full?
Where's your armor?"
Armor? Yasna sighed softly, opening up the sketch pad again. "Shallan," she said in a strangely comforting tone, "I'm impressed. I am impressed, truly. But what I've heard of you recently is troubling. You've ingratiated yourself with my family, and made good on the causal betrothal to Adolin. Yet here you are with wandering eyes, as this sketch testifies." You skip meetings that Dalinar calls," Yasna continued, soft but immovable. "When you do go, you sit at the back and barely pay attention. He tells me that half the time you find an excuse to slip out early. You investigated the presence of an unmaid in the tower, and frightened it off, basically alone. Yet you never explained how you found it, when Dalinar's soldiers could not." She met Shallan's eyes. "You've always hidden things from me. Some of those secrets were very damaging, and I find myself unwilling to believe you don't have others." Shallan bit her lip, but nodded. "That was an invitation," Yasna said, "to talk to me." Shallan nodded again. "She wasn't working with the Ghost Bloods. That was Vale. And Yasna didn't need to know about Vale. Yasna couldn't know about Vale." "Very well," Yasna said with a sigh. "Your wardship is not finished, and won't be until I'm convinced that you can meet minimum requirements of scholarship, such as taking shorthand notes during an important conference. Your path as a Radiant is another matter. I don't know that I can guide you. Each order was distinctive in its approach. But as a young man will not be excused from his geography lessons simply because he has achieved competence with the sword, I will not release you from your duties to me simply because you have discovered your powers as a Radiant." Yasna handed back the sketchpad and walked toward the ring of chairs. She settled next to Renarin, prodding him gently to speak with her. He looked up for the first time since the meeting had begun and nodded, saying something Shallan couldn't hear. Pattern said. "She is wise."
"That's perhaps her most infuriating feature," Shallan said. "Storms. She makes me feel like a child."
"Worst part is she's probably right," Shallan said. "Around her, I do act more like a child. It's like part of me wants to let her take care of everything, and I hate, hate, hate that about myself. Is there a solution? I don't know. Perhaps act like an adult?"
Shallan put her hands to her face, groaning softly and rubbing her eyes with her fingers. She'd basically asked for that, hadn't she? "Come on," she said. "Let's go to the rest of the meeting. As much as I want an excuse to get out of here."
Pattern said. "Something about this room."
"What?" Shallan asked.
"Something," Pattern said in his buzzing way. "It has memories, Shallan."
Memories? Did he mean in Shadesmar? She'd avoided traveling there. That was at least one thing in which she'd listened to Yasna. She made her way back to her seat, and after a moment's thought, slipped Yasna a quick note. "Pattern says this room has memories. Worth investigating in Shadesmar?" Jasnah regarded the note, then wrote back. I found that we should not ignore the offhand comments of our Spren. Press him. I will investigate this place. Thank you for the suggestion. The meeting started again, and now turned to discussion of specific kingdoms around Roshar. Jasnah was most keen on getting the Shin to join them. The Shattered Plains held the easternmost of the Oath Gates, and that was already under Alethi control. If they could gain access to the one farthest to the west, they could travel the breadth of Roshar, from the entry point of the High Storms to the entry point of the Everstorms, in a heartbeat. They didn't talk tactics too specifically. That was a masculine art, and Dalinar would want his high princes and generals to discuss the battlefields. Still, Shallan didn't fail to notice the tactical terms Jasnah used now and then. In things like this, Shallan had difficulty understanding the woman. In some ways, Jasnah seemed fiercely masculine. She studied whatever she pleased, and she talked tactics as easily as she talked poetry. She could be aggressive, even cold. Shallan had seen her straight up execute thieves who had tried to rob her. Beyond that, well, it probably was best not to speculate on things with no meaning, but people did talk. Jasnah had turned down every suitor for her hand, including some very attractive and influential men. People wondered, was she perhaps simply not interested? All of this should have resulted in a person who was decidedly unfeminine. Yet Jasnah wore the finest makeup and wore it well, with shadowed eyes and bright red lips. She kept her safe hand covered, and preferred intricate and fetching styles of braids from her hairdresser. Her writings and her mind made her the very model of Vorin femininity. Next to Jasnah, Shallan felt pale, stupid, and completely lacking in curves. What would it be like to be so confident, so beautiful yet so unconstrained all at once? Surely Jasnah Kolin had far fewer problems in life than Shallan. At the very least, she created far fewer for herself than Shallan did. It was about this point that Shallan realized she'd missed a good 15 minutes of the meeting and had again lapsed in her note-taking. Blushing furiously, she huddled up on her chair and did her best to remain focused for the rest of the meeting. At the end, she presented a sheet of formal shorthand to Jasnah. The woman looked it over, then cocked a perfectly shaped eyebrow at the line at the center where Shallan had grown distracted. "Dalinar said some stuff here," the line said. "It was very important and useful, so I'm sure you remember it without needing a reminder." Shallan smiled apologetically and shrugged. "Please write this out in longhand," Jasnah said, handing it back. "Have a copy sent to my mother, and to my brother's head scribe." Shallan took it as a dismissal and rushed away. She felt like a student who had just been released from lessons, which angered her. At the same time, she wanted to run off and immediately do as Jasnah had asked, to renew her mistress's faith in her, which angered her even more. She ran up the steps out of the tower's basement, using stormlight to prevent fatigue. The different sides within her clashed, snapping at each other. She imagined months spent under Jasnah's watchful care, training to become a mousy scribe, as her father had always wanted. She remembered the days in Carbranth, when she'd been so uncertain, so timid. She couldn't return to that. She wouldn't. But what to do instead? When she finally reached her rooms, Pattern was buzzing at her. She tossed aside her sketch pad and satchel, digging out Vale's coat and hat. Vale would know what to do. However, pinned to the inside of Vale's coat was a sheet of paper. Shallan froze, then looked around the room, suddenly anxious. Hesitantly, she unpinned the sheet and unfolded it. The top read, "You have accomplished the task we set out for you. You have investigated the Unmade, and not only learned something of it, but also frightened it away. As promised,
Here is your reward. The following letter explains the truth about your deceased brother, Nan Helleran, acolyte of the Radiant Order of the Skybreakers. 40. Questions, peaks, and inferences. As for Uli Da, it was obvious from the outset that she was going to be a problem. Good riddance. There are at least two major institutions on Roshar, other than ourselves, which presaged the return of the Voidbringers and the Desolations. The letter read, "You are familiar with the first of these, the men who call themselves the Sons of Honor, the old king of Alethkar, the Blackthorn's brother. Gavilar Kolin was a driving force in their expansion. He brought Meridas Amaram into their fold. As you no doubt discovered upon infiltrating Amaram's mansion in the war camps, the Sons of Honor explicitly worked for the return of the Desolations. They believed that only the Voidbringers would cause the Heralds to show themselves, and they believed that a Desolation would restore both the Knights Radiant and the classical strength of the Vorin Church. King Gavilar's efforts to rekindle the Desolations are likely the true reason he was assassinated, though there were many in the palace that night who had reason to see him dead. A second group who knew the Desolations might return are the Skybreakers, led by the ancient herald Nalan Ilin, often simply called Nail. The Skybreakers are the only order of Radiance that did not betray its oaths during the Recreants. They have maintained a continuous clandestine line from ancient days. Nail believed that men speaking the words of other orders would hasten the return of the Voidbringers. We do not know how this could possibly be true, but as a herald, Nail has access to knowledge and understanding beyond us. You should know that the Heralds are no longer to be seen as allies to man. Those that are not completely insane have been broken. Nail himself is ruthless, without pity or mercy. He has spent the last 2 decades, perhaps much longer, dealing with anyone close to bonding a Spren. Sometimes he recruited these people, bonding them to High Spren and making them Skybreakers. Others he eliminated. If the person had already bonded a Spren, then Nail usually went in person to dispatch them. If not, he sent a minion. A minion, like your brother, Helleran. Your mother had intimate contact with the Skybreaker acolyte, and you know the result of that relationship. Your brother was recruited because Nail was impressed with him. Nail may also have learned, through means we do not understand, that a member of your house was close to bonding a Spren. If this is true, they came to believe that Helleran was the one they wanted. They recruited him with displays of great power and shards. Helleran had not yet proved himself worthy of a Spren bond. Nail is exacting with his recruits. Likely, Helleran was sent to kill Amaram as a test. Either that, or he took it upon himself as a way of proving his worthiness for knighthood. It is also possible that the Skybreakers knew someone in Amaram's army was close to bonding a Spren, but I believe it likelier that the attack on Amaram was simply a strike against the Sons of Honor. From our spying upon the Skybreakers, we have records showing the only member of Amaram's army to have bonded a Spren was long since eliminated. The Bridgeman was not, so far as we understand, known to them. If he had been, he would certainly have been killed during his months as a slave. It ended there. Shallan sat in her room, lit only by the faintest sphere. Helleran? A Skybreaker? And King Gavilar? Working with Amaram to bring back the Desolations? Pattern buzzed with concern on her skirts and moved up onto the page, reading the letter. She whispered the words again to herself to memorize them, for she knew she couldn't keep this letter. It was too dangerous.
"Secrets," Pattern said. "There are lies in this letter."
So many questions.
Who else had been there on the night Gavilar had died, as the letter hinted? And what about this reference to another surge binder in Amram's army?
He's dangling tidbits in front of me, Shallan said.
Like a man on the docks who has a trained curl that will dance and wave its arms for fish.
But we want those tidbits, don't we?
That's why it works.
Storm it.
She couldn't deal with this at the moment. She took a memory of the page. It wasn't a particularly efficient method in regards to text, but it would work in a pinch. Then she stuffed the letter in a basin of water and washed off the ink, before shredding it and wadding it into a ball. From there, she changed into her coat, trousers, and hat, and snuck from the rooms as Vale. Vale found Vatha and some of his men playing at pieces in their barracks common room. Though this was for Sabariel's soldiers, she saw men in blue uniforms as well. Dalinar had ordered his men to spend time with the soldiers of his allies to help foster a sense of camaraderie. Vale's entrance drew glances, but not stares. Women were allowed in such common rooms, though few came. Little sounded less appealing to a woman being courted than, "Hey, let's go sit in the barracks common room and watch men grunt and scratch themselves." She sauntered over to where Vatha and his men had set up at a round wooden table. Furniture was finally trickling down to the ordinary men. Shallan even had a bed now. Vale settled down in a seat and leaned back, tipping the chair so it clicked against the stone wall. This large common room reminded her of a wine cellar, dark, unadorned, and filled with a variety of unusual stenches.
"Vale?" Vatha said, nodding to her.
Four of them were playing at this table. Vatha, One-Eyed Gaz, Lanky Red, and Shob. The latter wore a glyph ward wrapped around one arm and sniffled periodically. Vale leaned her head back.
"I seriously need something to drink." "I've got an extra mug or two on my ration," Red said cheerfully.
Vale eyed him to see if he was hitting on her again. He was smiling, but otherwise didn't seem to be making a pass.
"Right kind of you, Red," Vale said, digging out a few chips and tossing them to him.
He tossed over his requisition chit, a little piece of metal with his number stamped on it. A short time later, she was back in her place, nursing some Lavis beer.
"Tough day," Vatha said, lining up his pieces.
The small stone bricks were about the size of a thumb, and the men each had 10 of them that they arranged face down. The betting started soon after. Apparently Vatha was the mink for this round.
"Yeah," she replied. "Shallan's been an even bigger pain than usual."
The men grunted. "It's like she can't decide who she is, you know," Vale continued. "One moment she's cracking jokes like she's sitting in a knitting circle with old ladies. The next she's staring at you with that hollow gaze, the one that makes you think her soul has gone vacant." "She's a strange one, our mistress," Vatha agreed.
"Makes you want to do things," Gaz said with a grunt. "Things you never thought you'd do." "Yeah," Glurv said from the next table over. "I got a medal. Me. For helping find that mess hiding in the basement. Old Colin himself sent it down for me."
The overweight soldier shook his head, bemused. But he was wearing the medal, pinned right to his collar.
"It was fun," Gaz admitted. "Going out carousing, but feeling like we were doing something. That's what she promised us, you know? Making a difference again." "The difference I want to make," Vatha said, "is filling my pouch with your spheres, you men betting or not."
The four players all tossed in some spheres. Pieces was one of those games that the Vorin Church grudgingly allowed, as it involved no randomization. Dice, drawing from a deck of cards, even shuffling up the pieces. Betting on such things was like trying to guess the future. And that was so deeply wrong. Thinking of it made Vale's skin crawl. She wasn't even particularly religious. Not like Shallan was. People wouldn't play games like those in the official barracks. Here they played guessing games. Vatha had arranged 9 of his pieces in a triangle shape. The 10th one he set to the side and flipped over as the seed. It, like the hidden 9, was marked with the symbol of one of the Alethi princedoms. In this case, the seed was Aladar's symbol, in the form of a chul. The goal was to arrange your 10 pieces in a pattern identical to his, even though they were face down. You'd guess which were which through a series of questions, peeks, and inferences. You could force the mink to reveal pieces just to you or to everyone, based on certain other rules. In the end, someone called, and everyone flipped over their pieces. The one with the most matches to the mink's pattern was declared winner and claimed the pot. The mink got a percentage, based on certain factors, such as the number of turns it took before someone called.
"What do you think?"
Gaz asked as he tossed a few chips into the bowl at the center, buying the right to peek at one of Vatha's tiles.
"How long will Shallan go this time before she remembers we're here?"
"Long time, I hope,"
Shob said.
"I think I might be coming down with something."
"So all is normal, Shob," Red said.
"It's big this time,"
Shob said.
"I think I might be turning into a void bringer."
"A void bringer," Vale said flatly.
"Yeah. Look at this rash."
He pulled back the glyph ward, exposing his upper arm, which looked perfectly normal. Vatha snorted.
"Eh,"
Shob said.
"I'm likely to die, Sarge. You mark me. I'm likely to die."
He moved around a few of his tiles.
"If I do, give my winnings to dem orphans."
"Dem orphans?" Red asked.
"You know, orphans."
Shob scratched his head.
"There's orphans, right? Somewhere? Orphans that need food? Give them mine after I die."
"Shob," Vatha said. "With the way justice plays out in this world, I can guarantee you'll outlive the rest of us."
"Oh, that's nice," Shob said. "Right nice, Sarge."
The game progressed only a few rounds before Shob started flipping over his tiles.
"Already?" Gaz said. "Shob, you Kremling, don't do it yet. I don't even have 2 lines."
"Too late," Shob said.
Red and Gaz reluctantly started flipping their tiles.
"Sadius,"
Shallan said absently. "Bethab, Ruthar, Rowian, Thanadol, Colin, Sabariel, Vama, Hatham, with Aladar as the seed." Vatha gaped at her, then flipped the tiles over, revealing them exactly as she'd said.
"And you didn't even get any peeks. Storms, woman. Remind me never to play pieces with you."
"My brothers always said the same thing," she said, as he split the pot with Shob, who had gotten them all right but 3.
"Another hand?"
Gaz asked. Everyone looked at his bowl of spheres, which was almost empty.
"I can get a loan," he said quickly. "There's some fellows in Dalinar's guard who said..."
"Gaz," Vatha said.
"But seriously, Gaz."
Gaz sighed.
"Guess we can play for ends, then," he said.
And Shob eagerly got out some drops of glass shaped roughly like spheres, but without gemstones at the center. Fake money for gambling without stakes. Vale was enjoying her mug of beer more than she'd expected. It was refreshing to sit here with these men and not have to worry about all Shallan's problems. Couldn't that girl just relax? Let it all blow past her? Nearby, some washwomen entered, calling that laundry pickup would be in a few minutes. Vatha and his men didn't stir, though by Vale's estimation, the very clothing they were wearing could use a good scrub. Unfortunately, Vale couldn't completely ignore Shallan's problems. Moraes' note proved how useful he could be, but she had to be careful. He obviously wanted a mole among the Knights Radiant. I need to turn this around on him. Learn what he knows. He told her what the Skybreakers and the Sons of Honor had been up to. But what about Moraes and his cohorts? What was their objective? Storms. Did she dare try to double-cross him? Did she really have the experience or the training to attempt something like that?
Hey, Vale, Vatha said as they prepped for another game. What do you think? Has the brightness already forgotten about us again?
Vale shook herself out of her thoughts.
Maybe. She doesn't seem to know what to do with you lot. She's not the first, Red said.
He was the next mink, and carefully arranged his tiles in a specific order, face down.
I mean, it's not like we're real soldiers. Our crimes are forgiven,
Gaz said with a grunt, squinting his single eye at the seed tile that Red turned over.
But forgiven ain't forgotten. No military will take us on, and I don't blame them. I'm just glad those storming bridgemen haven't strung me up by my toes.
Bridgemen? Vale asked.
He's got a history with them, Vatha noted. I used to be their storming sergeant, Gaz said. Did everything I could to get them to run those bridges faster. Nobody likes their sergeant, though. I'm sure you were the perfect sergeant, Red said with a grin. I'll bet you really looked out for them, Gaz. Shut your creme hole,
Gaz grumbled.
Though I do wonder, if I'd been a little less hard on them, you think maybe I'd be out on that plateau right now, practicing like the lot of them do? Learning to fly? You think you could be a Knight Radiant, Gaz?
Vatha said, chuckling.
No. No, I guess I don't.
He eyed Vale.
Vale, you tell the brightness. We ain't good men. Good men, they'll find something useful to do with their time. We, on the other hand, might do the opposite.
The opposite?
Zendid said from the next table over, where a few of the others continued to drink.
Opposite of useful? I think we're already there, Gaz, and we've been there forever.
Not me, Glurv said. I've got a medal.
I mean, Gaz said, we might get into trouble. I liked being useful. Reminded me of back when I first joined up. You tell her, Vale. Tell her to give us something to do other than gambling and drinking. Because, to be honest, I ain't very good at either one.
Vale nodded slowly. A washwoman idled by, messing with a sack of laundry. Vale tapped her finger on her cup. Then she stood and seized the washwoman by the dress and hauled her backward. The woman shouted, dropping her pile of clothing as she stumbled, nearly falling. Vale shoved her hand into the woman's hair, pushing away the wig of mottled brown and black. Underneath the woman's hair was pure alethi black, and she wore ashes on her cheeks, as if she'd been doing hard labor.
You,
Vale said. This was the woman from the tavern at All's Alley. What had her name been? Ishna? Several nearby soldiers had leapt up with alarmed expressions at the woman's outcry. Every one of those is a soldier from Dalinar's army, Vale noted, suppressing a roll of her eyes. Kolin troops did have a habit of assuming that nobody could take care of themselves.
Sit,
Vale said, pointing at the table. Red hastily pulled up another chair. Ishna settled herself, holding the wig to her chest. She blushed deeply, but maintained some measure of poise, meeting the eyes of Vatha and his men.
You are getting to be an annoyance, woman, Vale said, sitting.
Why do you assume I'm here because of you? Ishna said. You're jumping to conclusions.
You showed an unhealthy fascination with my associates. Now I find you in disguise, eavesdropping on my conversations.
Ishna raised her chin.
Maybe I'm just trying to prove myself to you.
with the disguise I saw through the moment I glanced at you?
You didn't catch me last time, Ishna said.
Last time?
You talked about where to get horn-eater lager, Ishna said. Red insisted it was nasty. Gaz loves it.
Storms. How long have you been spying on me?
Not long, Ishna said quickly, in direct contradiction to what she'd just said. But I can assure you, promise it, that I'll be more valuable to you than these rancid buffoons. Please at least let me try.
Buffoons, Gaz said. Rancid, Shob said. Oh, that's just my boils, miss.
Walk with me, Vale said, standing up. She strode away from the table. Ishna scrambled to her feet and followed.
I wasn't really trying to spy on you, but how else was I quiet? Vale said.
She stopped at the doorway to the barracks, far enough from her men that they couldn't hear. She folded her arms, leaning against the wall by the door and looking back at them. Shallan had trouble with follow-through. She had good intentions and grand plans, but she got diverted too easily by new problems, new adventures. Fortunately, Vale could pick up a few of those loose threads. These men had proven that they were loyal, and they wanted to be useful. A woman could be given much less than that to work with.
The disguise was well done, she said to Ishna. Next time, rough up your free hand some more. The fingers gave you away. They aren't the fingers of a laborer.
Ishna blushed, balling her free hand into a fist. Tell me what you can do and why I should care, Vale said. You have 2 minutes. Ishna took a deep breath.
I was trained as a spy for House Hammuradin. In Vama's court? I know information gathering, message coding, observation techniques, and how to search a room without revealing what I've done.
So? If you're so useful, what happened?
Your people happened. The Ghostbloods. I'd heard of them. Whispered of by Bright Lady Hammuradin. She crossed them somehow and then...
She shrugged.
She ended up dead, and everyone thought it might have been one of us who did it. I fled and ended up in the underground, working for a petty gang of thieves. But I could be so much more. Let me prove it to you.
Vale crossed her arms. A spy? That could be useful. Truth was, Vale herself didn't have much actual training, only what Tin had showed her and what she'd learned on her own. If she was going to dance with the Ghostbloods, she'd need to be better. Right now, she didn't even know what it was she didn't know. Could she get some of that from Ishna? Somehow get some training without revealing that Vale wasn't as skilled as she pretended to be? An idea began to take form. She didn't trust this woman, but then she didn't need to. And if her former Bright Lady really had been killed by the Ghostbloods, perhaps there was a secret to learn there.
I have some important infiltrations planned, Vale said. Missions where I need to gather information of a sensitive nature.
I can help, Ishna said.
What I really need is a support team so I don't have to go in alone.
I can find people for you, experts.
I wouldn't be able to trust them, Vale said, shaking her head. I need someone I know is loyal.
Who?
Vale pointed at Vatha and his men. Ishna's expression fell.
You want to turn those men into spies?
That, and I want you to prove to me what you can do by showing it to those men. And hopefully I can pick up something, too.
Don't look so daunted. They don't need to be true spies. They just need to know enough about my work to support me and keep watch.
Ishna raised her eyebrows skeptically, watching the men. Shob was obligingly picking his nose.
That's a little like saying you want me to teach hogs to talk, with promises it will be easy as they only need to speak Alethi, not Vaden or Herdazian.
This is the chance I'm offering, Ishna. Take it, or agree to stay away from me.
Ishna sighed.
All right, we'll see. Just don't blame me if the pigs don't end up talking.
41. on the ground, looking up. Regardless, this is not your concern. You turned your back on divinity. If race becomes an issue, he will be dealt with. And so will you. Teft woke up. Unfortunately, his first sensation was pain. Old, familiar pain. The throbbing behind his eyes, the raw biting needles of his burned fingers, the stiffness of a body that had outlived its usefulness. Kalek's breath. Had he ever been useful? He rolled over, groaning. No coat. Only a tight undershirt, soiled from lying on the ground. He was in an alleyway between tents and the breakaway market. The high ceiling vanished into the darkness. From just beyond the alleyway came the bright sounds of people chatting and haggling. Teft stumbled to his feet and was halfway through relieving himself against some empty boxes before he realized what he was doing. There were no high storms in here to wash the place out. Besides, he wasn't some drunkard who wallowed in filth and pissed in alleys, was he? That thought immediately reminded him of the deeper pain, a pain beyond the pounding in his head or the ache of his bones. The pain that was with him always, like a persistent ringing cutting deep to his core. This pain had awakened him. The pain of need. No, he wasn't just some drunkard. He was far, far worse. He stumbled out of the alleyway trying to smooth his hair and beard. Women he passed held safe hands to mouths and noses, looking away as if embarrassed for him. Perhaps it was a good thing he'd lost his coat. Storms help him if anyone recognized who he was. He'd shame the entire crew.
You're already ashamed of the crew, Teft, and you know it, he thought. You're a godless waste of spit.
He eventually found his way to the well, where he slouched in a line behind some others. Once at the water, he fell down on his knees, then used a trembling hand to fish out a drink with his tin cup. Once he tasted the cool water, his stomach immediately cramped, rejecting it even though he was parched. This always happened after a night on the moss, so he knew to ride the nausea and the cramps, hoping he could keep the water down. He slumped, holding his stomach, frightening the people in line behind him. Out in the crowd, there was always at least a small crowd near the well, some men in uniforms shoved through. Forest Green, Satius's men. They ignored the lines, then filled their buckets. When a man in Colin Blue objected, Satius's soldiers got right up in his face. The Colin soldier finally backed down. Good lad. They didn't need another brawl starting between Satius's men and other soldiers. Teft dipped his cup again, the pain from his previous sip fading. This well seemed deep. Rippling water on top and a deep blackness below. He almost threw himself in. If he woke up in damnation tomorrow, would he still feel that itching need inside? That would be a fitting torment. Voidbringers wouldn't even have to flay his soul. All they'd need to do was tell him he'd never feel sated again, and then they could watch him squirm. Reflected in the waters of the well, a face appeared over his shoulder. A woman with pale white skin, glowing faintly, and hair that hovered around her head like clouds.
You leave me alone, he said, slapping his hand into the water. You just go find someone who cares.
He stumbled back to his feet, finally getting out of the way so someone else could take a spot. Storms, what hour was it? Those women with buckets were ready to draw water for the day. The drunken nighttime crowds had been replaced by the enterprising and industrious. He'd been out all night, again. Kalek! Returning to the barracks would be the smart thing to do. But could he face them like this? He wandered through the market instead, eyes down.
I'm getting worse, a piece of him realized.
The first month in Dalinar's employ, he'd been able to resist for the most part. But he'd had money again, after so long as a bridgeman. Having money was dangerous. He'd functioned, only mossing an evening here, an evening there. But then Kaladin had left,
and this tower, where everything had felt so wrong. Those monsters of darkness, including one that had looked just like Teft. He'd needed the moss to deal with that. Who wouldn't? He sighed. When he looked up, he found that Spren standing in front of him.
"Teft," she whispered, "you've spoken oaths."
Foolish, stupid oaths, spoken when he'd hoped that being radiant would remove the cravings. He turned away from her and found his way to a tent nestled among the taverns. Those were closed for the morning, but this place, it had no name and didn't need one, was open. It was always open, just like the ones back in Dalinar's war camp had been, just like the ones in Sadeus's war camp. They were harder to find in some places than others, but they were always there. Nameless, but still known. The tough-looking Herdazian man sitting at the front waved him in. It was dim inside, but Teft found his way to a table and slumped down. A woman in tight clothing and a glove with no fingers brought him a little bowl of fire moss. They didn't ask for payment. They all knew that he wouldn't have any spheres on him today, not after his binge last night. But they would make sure to get paid eventually. Teft stared at the little bowl, loathing himself, and yet the scent of it made his longing multiply tenfold. He let out a whimpering groan, then seized the fire moss and ground it between his thumb and forefinger. The moss let off a small plume of smoke, and in the dim light the center of the moss glowed like an ember. It hurt, of course. He'd worn through his calluses last night, and now rubbed the moss with raw, blistering fingers. But this was a sharp, present pain, a good kind of pain. Merely physical, it was a sign of life. It took a minute before he felt the effects, a washing away of his pains followed by a strengthening of his resolve. He could remember long ago that the fire moss had done more to him. He remembered euphoria, nights spent in a dizzy, wonderful daze where everything around him seemed to make sense. These days he needed the moss to feel normal. Like a man scrambling up wet rocks, he could barely reach where everyone else was standing before he slowly started sliding back down. It wasn't euphoria he craved anymore. It was the mere capacity to keep on going. The moss washed away his burdens. Memories of that dark version of himself. Memories of turning his family and his heretics, even though they'd been right all along. He was a wretch and a coward and didn't deserve to wear the symbol of Bridge Four. He'd as good as betrayed that Spren already. She'd best have fled. For a moment, he could give that all up to the fire moss. Unfortunately, there was something broken in Teft. Long ago, he'd gone to the moss at the urgings of other men in his squad in Sadeus's army. They could rub the stuff and get some benefit, like a man chewed ridge bark when on guard duty to stay awake. A little fire moss, a little relaxation, and then they moved on with their lives. Teft didn't work that way. Burdens shoved aside, he could have gotten up and gone back to the bridgeman. He could have started his day. But storms, a few more minutes sounded so nice. He kept going. He went through three bowls before a garish light made him blink. He pulled his face off the table where, to his shame, he drooled a puddle. How long had it been, and what was that terrible, awful light? "Here he is," Kaladin's voice said as Teft blinked. A figure knelt beside the table. "Oh, Teft. He owes us for three bowls," said the den's keeper. "One garnet brome."
"Be glad," an accented voice growled. "We do not rip off pieces of your body and pay you with those."
Storms. Rock was here too? Teft groaned, turning away.
"Don't see me," he croaked. "Don't. Our establishment is perfectly legal, Horn Eater," the denkeeper said. "If you assault us, be assured we will bring the guard, and they will defend us."
"Here's your blood money, you eel," Kaladin said, pushing the light toward them. "Rock, can you get him?" Large hands took Teft, surprisingly gentle with their touch. He was crying. Kalek. "Where's your coat, Teft?" Kaladin asked from the darkness.
I sold it,
Teft admitted, squeezing his eyes shut against the shame spren that drifted down around him in the shape of flower petals.
I sold my own storming coat.
Kaladin fell silent, and Teft let Rock carry him from the den. Halfway back, he finally managed to scrounge up enough dignity to complain about Rock's breath and make them let him walk on his own feet, with a little support under the arms. Teft envied better men than he. They didn't have the itch, the one that went so deep that it stung his soul. It was persistent, always with him, and couldn't ever be scratched, despite how hard he tried. Kaladin and Rock set him up in one of the barrack rooms, private, wrapped in blankets and with a bowl of Rock's stew in his hands. Teft made the proper noises, the ones they expected. Apologies, promises he would tell them if he was feeling the need again. Promises that he'd let them help him. Though he couldn't eat the stew, not yet. It would be another day before he could keep anything down. Storms, but they were good men. Better friends than he deserved. They were all growing into something grand, while Teft just stayed on the ground looking up. They left him to get some rest. He stared at the stew, smelling the familiar scent, not daring to eat it. He'd go back to work before the day was out, training bridgemen from the other crews. He could function. He could go for days pretending that he was normal. Storms he'd balanced everything in Sadius's army for years before taking one step too far, missing duty one too many times and landing himself in the bridge crews as punishment. Those months running bridges had been the only time in his adult life when he hadn't been dominated by the moss. But even back then, when he'd been able to afford a little alcohol, he'd known that eventually he'd find his way back. The liquor wasn't ever enough. Even as he braced himself to go to work for the day, one nagging thought overshadowed his mind. A shameful thought. I'm not going to get any more moss for a while, am I? That sinister knowledge hurt him more than anything. He was going to have to go a few excruciating days feeling like half a man. Days when he couldn't feel anything but his own self-loathing. Days living with the shame, the memories, the glances of other bridgemen. Days without any storming help whatsoever. That terrified him. 42. Consequences. Sephandrius, bearer of the first gem, you must know better than to approach us by relying upon presumption of past relationship. Inside the increasingly familiar vision, Dalinar carefully knocked an arrow, then released, sending a black-fletched missile into the back of the wild man. The man's screech was lost in the cacophony of battle. Ahead, men fought frantically as they were pushed backward toward the edge of a cliff. Dalinar methodically knocked a second arrow, then loosed. This arrow hit as well, lodging in a man's shoulder. The man dropped his axe mid-swing, causing him to miss the young, dark-skinned youth lying on the ground. The boy was barely into his teens. The awkwardness hadn't left him yet, and he had limbs that seemed too long, a face that was too round, too childlike. Dalinar might have let him run messages, but not hold a spear. The lad's age hadn't prevented him from being named Prime Akasix Yanagon I, ruler of Aesir, emperor of Greater Makabak. Dalinar had perched on some rocks, bow in hand. While he didn't intend to repeat his mistake of letting Queen Fen manage all on her own in a vision, he also didn't want Yanagon to slip through it without challenge or stress. There was a reason that the Almighty had often put Dalinar in danger in these visions. He'd needed a visceral understanding of what was at stake. He felled another enemy who got close to the boy. The shots weren't difficult from his vantage near the fight. He had some training with the bow, though his archery in recent years had been with so-called shard bows, fabrial bows crafted with such a heavy draw weight that only a man in shard plate could use them. It was strange experiencing this battle for the third time.
Though each repetition played out slightly differently, there were certain familiar details. The sense of smoke and moldy, inhuman blood. The way that man below fell after losing an arm, screaming the same half-prayer, half-condemnation of the Almighty. With Dalinar's bowmanship, the band of defenders lasted against the enemy until that radiant climbed up over the edge of the cliff, glowing in shardplate. Emperor Yanagon sat down as the other soldiers rallied around the radiant and pushed the enemy backward. Dalinar lowered his bow, reading the terror in the youth's trembling figure. Other men spoke of getting the shakes when a fight was over, the horror of it catching up with them. The Emperor finally stumbled to his feet, using the spear like a staff. He didn't notice Dalinar, didn't even question why some of the bodies around him had arrows in them. This boy was no soldier, though Dalinar hadn't expected him to be one. From his experience, Azish generals were too pragmatic to want the throne. It involved too much pandering to bureaucrats and, apparently, dictating essays. The youth started down a path away from the cliff, and Dalinar followed. Ahare Etiam. The people who lived through this had thought it the end of the world. Surely they'd assumed they'd soon return to the tranquiline halls. How would they respond to the information that, after 4 millennia, mankind still hadn't been allowed back into heaven? The boy stopped at the bottom of the twisting path which led into the valley between rock formations. He watched wounded men limp by, supported by friends. Moans and shouts rose in the air. Dalinar intended to step up and start explaining about these visions, but the boy strode out to walk beside some wounded men, chatting with them. Dalinar followed, curious, catching fragments of the conversation. What happened here? Who are you? Why were you fighting? The men didn't have many answers. They were wounded, exhausted, trailed by pain spren. They did find their way to a larger group, though, in the direction Yasna had gone during Dalinar's previous visit to this vision. The crowd had gathered around a man standing on a large boulder. Tall and confident, the man was in his 30s, and he wore white and blue. He had an Alethi feel to him, except not quite. His skin was a shade darker, and something was faintly off about his features. Yet there was something familiar about the man. "You must spread the word," the man proclaimed. "We have won. At long last, the Voidbringers are defeated. This is not my victory, or that of the other heralds. It is your victory. You have done this." Some of the people shouted in triumph. Too many others stood silent, staring with dead eyes. "I will lead the charge for the Tranquiline Halls," the man shouted. "You will not see me again, but think not on that now. You have won your peace. Revel in it. Rebuild. Go now. Help your fellows. Carry with you the light of your herald king's words. We are victorious, at long last, over evil." Another round of shouts, more energetic this time. Storms, Dalinar thought, feeling a chill. This was Ysereza Ilin himself, herald of kings, the greatest among them. Wait, did the king have dark eyes? The group broke up, but the young emperor remained, staring at the place where the herald had stood. Finally he whispered, "O Ysir, King of the Heralds." "Yes," Dalinar said, stepping up beside him. "That was him, Your Excellency. My niece visited this vision earlier, and she wrote that she thought she'd spotted him." Yanagon grabbed Dalinar by the arm.
"What did you say? You know me?"
"You are Yanagon of Azir," Dalinar said. He nodded his head in a semblance of a bow. "I am Dalinar Kholin, and I apologize that our meeting must take place under such irregular circumstances." The youth's eyes widened.
"I see Ysir himself first, and now my enemy."
"I am not your enemy," Dalinar sighed. "And this is no mere dream, Your Excellency.
I know it's not a dream," Yanagon said. "As I am a prince raised to the throne miraculously, the heralds may choose to speak through me.
He looked about.
This day we are living through. It is the day of glory.
Ahari Etion, Delinar said. Yes.
Why did they place you here? What does it mean?
They didn't place me here, Delinar said. Your Excellency, I instigated this vision, and I brought you into it. Skeptical, the boy folded his arms. He wore the leather skirt provided by the vision. He'd left his bronze-tipped spear leaning against a rock nearby. Have you been told, Delinar asked, that I am considered mad?
There are rumors.
Well, this was my madness, Delinar said. I suffered visions during the storms. Come, see. He led Yonagon to a better view of the large field of the dead, which spread out from the mouth of the canyon. Yonagon followed, then his face grew ashen at the sight. Finally, he strode down onto the larger battlefield, moving among the corpses, moans, and curses. Delinar walked beside him. So many dead eyes, so many faces twisted in pain, light-eyed and dark, pale skin like the Shin and some horn-eaters, dark skin like the Makabaki, many that could have been Alethi, Vaden, or Herdazian. There were other things, of course. The giant broken stone figures, parchmen wearing war form, with chitin armor and orange blood. One spot they passed had a whole heap of strange kremlings, burned and smoking. Who would have taken the time to pile up 1,000 little crustaceans?
We fought together,
Yonagon said. How else could we have resisted, Delinar said. To fight the desolation alone would be madness. Yonagon eyed him.
You wanted to talk to me without the viziers. You wanted me alone. And you can just... You just show me whatever will strengthen your argument.
If you accept that I have the power to show you these visions, Delinar said, would that not in itself imply that you should listen to me?
The Alethi are dangerous. Do you know what happened the last time the Alethi were in Aesir?
The Sunmaker's rule was a long time ago.
The viziers have talked about this, Yonagon said. They told me all about it. It started the same way back then, with the warlord uniting the Alethi tribes.
Tribes? Delinar said. You'd compare us to the nomads that roamed Tubela? Alethkar is one of the most cultured kingdoms on Roshar.
Your code of law is barely 30 years old.
Your Excellency, Delinar said, taking a deep breath, I doubt this line of conversation will be relevant. Look around us. Look and see what the desolation will bring. He swept his hand across the awful view, and Yonagon's temper cooled. It was impossible to feel anything but sorrow when confronted by so much death. Eventually, Yonagon turned and started back the way they'd come. Delinar joined him, hands clasped behind.
They say, Yonagon whispered, that when the Sunmaker rode out of the passes and into Aesir, he had one unexpected problem. He conquered my people too quickly, and didn't know what to do with all of his captives. He couldn't leave a fighting population behind him in the towns. There were thousands upon thousands of men he needed to murder. Sometimes he'd simply assign the work to his soldiers. Every man was to kill 30 captives, like a child who had to find an armload of firewood before being allowed to play. In other places, the Sunmaker declared something arbitrary, say that every man with hair beyond a certain length was to be slaughtered. Before he was struck down with disease by the heralds, he murdered 10% of the population of Aesir. They say Zophix was filled with the bones, blown by high storms into piles as tall as the buildings.
I am not my ancestor, Delinar said softly.
You revere him? The Alethi all but worship Sadies. You carry his storming shard blade.
I gave that away. They stopped at the edge of the battlefield. The Emperor had grit, but didn't know how to carry himself. He walked with shoulders slumped, and his hands kept reaching for pockets his antiquated clothing didn't have. He was of low birth, though in Aesir they didn't properly revere eye color. Navani had once told him it was because there weren't enough people in Aesir with light eyes. The Sunmaker himself had used this to justify conquering them.
"I am not my ancestor," Dalinar repeated. "But I do share much with him. A youth of brutality, a lifetime spent at war. I have one advantage he did not."
"Which is?"
Dalinar met the young man's eyes.
"I've lived long enough to see the consequences of what I've done."
Yanagon nodded slowly.
"Yeah," a voice piped up. "You're old."
Dalinar turned, frowning. That had sounded like a young girl. Why would there be a girl on the battlefield?
"I didn't expect you to be so old," the girl said.
She sat perched cross-legged on a large boulder nearby.
"And you're not really that black. They called you Blackthorn, but you're really more like Dark Tan Thorn. Gox is more black than you are, and even he's pretty brownish."
The young emperor, remarkably, burst into an enormous grin.
"Lift! You're back!"
He started climbing up the boulder, heedless of decorum.
"Not quite back," she said. "Got sidetracked. But I'm close now."
"What happened in Yeddah?"
Yanagon said, eager.
"You barely gave me any kind of explanation."
"Those people lie about their food."
She narrowed her eyes at Dalinar as the young emperor slipped down the boulder, then tried to climb up another side.
"This is not possible," the Stormfather said in Dalinar's mind. "How did she come here?"
"You didn't bring her in," Dalinar said softly.
"No, this is not possible. How?"
Yanagon finally attained the top of the boulder and gave the younger girl a hug. She had long dark hair, pale white eyes, and tan skin. Though she likely wasn't a Lethi, the face was too round. Reshi, perhaps?
"He's trying to convince me I should trust him,"
Yanagon said, pointing at Dalinar.
"Don't," she said. "He's got too nice a butt."
Dalinar cleared his throat.
"What?"
"Your butt is too nice. Old guys shouldn't have tight butts. It means you spend way too much time swinging a sword or punching people. You should have an old, flabby butt. Then I'd trust you."
"She has a thing about butts,"
Yanagon said.
"No, I don't," the girl said, rolling her eyes. "If someone thinks I'm strange for talking about butts, it's usually because they're jealous, because I'm the only one without something rammed up mine."
She narrowed her eyes at Dalinar, then took the emperor by the arm.
"Let's go."
"But,"
Dalinar said, raising his hand.
"See? You're learning,"
she grinned at him. Then she and the emperor vanished. The Stormfather rumbled in frustration.
"That woman. This is a creation specifically meant to defy my will."
"Woman?" Dalinar asked, shaking his head.
"That child is tainted by the Night Watcher."
"Technically, so am I."
"This is different. This is unnatural. She goes too far."
The Stormfather rumbled his discontent, refusing to speak to Dalinar further. He seemed genuinely upset. In fact, Dalinar was forced to sit and wait until the vision finished. He spent the time staring out over that field of the dead, haunted equally by the future and the past. 43. Spearmen.
"You have spoken to one who cannot respond. We instead will take your communication to us, though we know not how you located us upon this world." Moash picked at the mush that Febrith called a stew. It tasted like creme. He stared at the flame spren in their large cook fire, trying to warm himself as Febrith, a Thalen man with striking horn-eater red hair, argued with Graves. The fire's smoke curled into the air, and the light would be visible for miles across the Frostlands.
Graves didn't care. He figured that if the Everstorm hadn't cleared the bandits out of the area, two Shardbearers would be more than enough to deal with any who remained.
Shardblades can't stop an arrow in the back, Moash thought, feeling exposed. And neither can plate, if we're not wearing it.
His armor and that of Graves lay bundled in their wagon.
Look, that is the triplets, Graves said, waving toward a rock formation. It's right here on the map. We go west now.
I've been this way before, Febreth said. We must continue south, you see. Then east.
The map!
I have no need for your maps, Febreth said, folding his arms. The passions guide me.
The passions? Graves said, throwing his hands up. The passions? You're supposed to have abandoned such superstitions. You belong to the diagram now.
I can do both, Febreth said solemnly.
Moash stuffed another spoonful of stew into his mouth. Storms, he hated it when Febreth took a turn cooking, and when Graves took a turn, and when Fia took a turn, and, well, the stuff Moash himself cooked tasted like spiced dishwater. None of them could cook worth a dun chip. Not like rock. Moash dropped his bowl, letting the mush slop over the side. He grabbed his coat off a tree branch and stalked out into the night. The cold air felt strange on his skin after so long in front of the fire. He hated how cold it was down here. Perpetual winter. The four of them had suffered through the storms, hiding in the cramped, reinforced bottom of their wagon, which they'd chained to the ground. They'd frightened away rogue parchmen with their shard blades. They hadn't been nearly as dangerous as he'd worried. But that new storm... Moash kicked at a rock, but it was frozen to the ground, and he just stubbed his toe. He cursed, then glanced over his shoulder as the argument ended in shouts. He'd once admired how refined Graves seemed. That had been before spending weeks crossing a barren landscape together. The man's patience had frayed to threads, and his refinement didn't matter much when they were all eating slop and pissing behind hills.
So how lost are we? Moash asked as Graves joined him in the darkness outside camp.
Not lost at all, Graves said. If that idiot would actually look at a map.
He glanced at Moash.
I've told you to get rid of that coat.
Which I'll do, Moash said, when we're not crawling across winter's own frozen backside.
At least take the patch off. It might give us away if we meet someone from the war camps. Rip it off!
Graves turned on his heel and walked back toward camp. Moash felt to the Bridge 4 patch on his shoulder. It brought memories. Joining Graves and his band who had been planning to kill King Elokar, an assassination attempt once Dalinar was away, marching toward the center of the Shattered Plains. Facing off against Kaladin, wounded and bleeding.
You will not have him.
Moash's skin had gone clammy from the cold. He slid his knife from his side sheath. He still wasn't used to being able to carry one that long. A knife that was too big could get you into trouble as a Dark Eyes. He wasn't dark-eyed anymore. He was one of them. Storms, he was one of them. He cut the stitches on the Bridge 4 patch. Up one side, then down the other. How simple it was. It would be harder to remove the tattoo he'd gotten with the others, but that he'd had placed on his shoulder, not his forehead. Moash held up the patch, trying to catch the firelight for a last look, and then couldn't bring himself to throw it away. He walked back and settled by the fire. Were the others sitting around Rock's stew pot somewhere? Laughing, joking, betting on how many mugs of ale Lopin could drink, ribbing Kaladin, trying to get him to crack a smile. Moash could almost hear their voices, and he smiled, imagining that he was there. Then he imagined Kaladin telling them what Moash had done.
He tried to kill me, Kaladin would say. He betrayed everything. His oath to protect the king,
his duty to Alethkar, but most importantly, us. Moash sagged, patch in his fingers. He should throw the thing in the fire. Storms. He should throw himself in the fire. He looked up toward the skies, toward both Damnation and the Tranquiline Halls. A group of starspren quivered above. And beside them, something moving in the sky? Moash shouted, throwing himself backward off his perch as four Voidbringers descended upon the little camp. They smashed into the ground, wielding long, sinuous swords, not shard blades. Those were Parshendi weapons. One creature struck where Moash had been sitting an instant before. Another creature stabbed Graves straight through the chest, then yanked the weapon free and beheaded him with a backhand swipe. Graves' corpse tumbled, and his shard blade materialized, clanging to the ground. Febreth and Fia didn't have a chance. Other Voidbringers struck them down, spilling their blood in this cold, forgotten land. The fourth Voidbringer came for Moash, who threw himself into a roll. The creature's sword slammed down near him, hitting rock, the blade throwing sparks. Moash rolled to his feet, and Kaladin's training, drilled into him through hours and hours spent at the bottom of a chasm, took over. He danced away, putting his back to the wagon, as his shard blade fell into his fingers. The Voidbringer rounded the fire toward him, light glittering from her taut, muscular body. These weren't like the Parshendi he'd seen on the Shattered Plains. They had deep red eyes and red-violet carapace, some of which framed their faces. The one facing him had a swirling pattern to her skin, three different colors mixing, red, black, white. Dark light, like inverse stormlight, clung to each of them. Graves had spoken of these creatures, calling their return merely one of the events predicted by the inscrutable diagram. Moash's foe came for him, and he lashed out with his blade, driving her back. She seemed to glide as she moved, feet barely touching the ground. The other three ignored him, instead picking through the camp, inspecting the bodies. One soared in a graceful leap onto the wagon and began digging in the items there. His opponent tried again, carefully sweeping her long curved sword at him. Moash shied back, shard blade gripped with both hands, trying to intercept her weapon. His motions seemed clumsy compared to the graceful power of this creature. She slipped to the side, clothing rippling in the wind, breath visible in the cold air. She wasn't taking chances against a shard blade and didn't strike as Moash stumbled. Storms, this weapon was just too clunky. 6 feet long, it was hard to angle right. Yes, it could cut through anything, but he needed to actually hit for that to matter. It had been much easier to wield the thing wearing plate. Without it, he felt like a child holding an adult's weapon. The Voidbringer smiled. Then she struck with blurring speed. Moash stepped back, swinging, forcing her to twist to the side. He took a long cut up the arm, but his move prevented her from impaling him. His arm flared with pain, and he grunted. The Voidbringer regarded him confidently, knowingly. He was dead. Maybe he should simply let it happen. The Voidbringer working in the cart said something eager, excited. He'd found the shard plate. He kicked other items while digging it free, and something rolled out the back of the wagon, thumping against the stone. A spear. Moash looked down at his shard blade, the wealth of nations, the most valuable possession a man could own. Who am I kidding? He thought. Who did I ever think I was kidding? The Voidbringer woman launched into an attack, but Moash dismissed his shard blade and dashed away. His attacker was so surprised that she hesitated, and Moash had time to dive for the spear, rolling to his feet. Holding the smooth wood in his hand, a familiar weight, Moash snapped easily into his stance. The air suddenly smelled damp and faintly rotten. He remembered the chasms. Life and death together, vines and rot. He could almost hear Kaladin's voice. You can't fear a shard blade. You can't fear a light eyes on horseback. They kill with fear first and the sword second. Stand your ground. The Voidbringer came for him and Moash stood his ground. He turned her aside by catching her weapon on the haft of the spear. Then he thrust the butt end of the spear up underneath her arm as she came in for a backhand. The Voidbringer gasped in surprise as Moash executed a takedown he'd practiced 1,000 times in the chasms. He swung the butt of his spear at her ankles and swept her legs out from under her. He began to follow with a classic twist and thrust to stab down through her chest. Unfortunately, the Voidbringer didn't fall. She caught herself in the air, hovering instead of collapsing. Moash noticed in time and pulled out of his maneuver to block her next attack. The Voidbringer glided backward, then dropped to the ground in a prowling crouch, sword held to the side. She then leaped forward and grabbed Moash's spear as he tried to use it to ward her off. Storms! She gracefully pulled herself close to him, inside his reach. She smelled of wet clothing and of the alien, moldy scent he associated with the Parshendi. She pressed her hand against Moash's chest, and that dark light transferred from her to him. Moash felt himself grow lighter. Fortunately, Kaladin had tried this on him too. Moash seized the Voidbringer with one hand, holding onto the front of her loose shirt as his body tried to fall into the air. His sudden pull jerked her off balance, even lifted her a few inches. He yanked her up toward him with one hand, while pushing his spearhead down against the rocky ground. That sent the two of them spinning in the air, hovering. She cried out in an alien tongue. Moash dropped his spear and grabbed his knife. She tried to shove him away, lashing him again, stronger this time. He grunted but hung on and got his knife up and rammed it into her chest. Orange Parshendi blood poured around his hand, spraying into the cold night as they continued to spin in the air. Moash hung on tight and pushed the knife farther. She didn't heal as Kaladin would have. Her eyes stopped glowing, and the dark light vanished.
The body grew limp.
A short time later, the force pulling Moash upward ran out. He dropped the 5 feet to the ground, her body cushioning his fall. Orange blood coated him, steaming in the chill air. He seized his spear again, fingers slick with blood, and pointed it at the three remaining Voidbringers who regarded him with stunned expressions.
"Bridge four, you bastards," Moash growled.
Two of the Voidbringers turned toward the third, the other woman, who looked Moash up and down.
"You can probably kill me," Moash said, wiping a hand on his clothes to improve his grip. "But I'll take one of you with me. At least one."
They didn't seem angry that he'd killed their friend. Storms, though, did things like these even have emotions? Shenet often just sat around staring. He locked eyes with the woman at the center. Her skin was white and red, not a bit of black in it. The paleness of that white reminded him of the Shin, who always looked sickly to Moash.
"You," she said in accented Alethi, "have passion."
One of the others handed her Graves's shard blade. She held it up, inspecting it by the firelight. Then she rose into the air.
"You may choose," she said to him. "Die here, or accept defeat and give up your weapons."
Moash clung to the spear in the shadow of that figure, her clothing rippling in the air. Did they think he'd actually trust them? But then, did he really think he could stand against three of them? With a shrug, he tossed aside the spear. He summoned his blade. After all those years dreaming of one of these, he'd finally received one. Kaladin had given it to him. And what good had come of it? He obviously couldn't be trusted with such a weapon. Setting his jaw, Moash pressed his hand to the gemstone and willed the bond to break. The gemstone at its pommel flashed, and he felt an icy coolness wash through him. Back to being a Dark Eyes. He tossed the blade to the ground. One of the Voidbringers took it. Another flew off, and Moash was confused as to what was happening. A short time later, that one returned with six more. Three attached ropes to the shardplate bundles, then flew off, hauling the heavy armor into the air after them. Why not lash it? Moash thought for a moment they were actually going to leave him there. But finally two others grabbed him, one arm each, and hauled him into the air.
44. The Bright Side. We are indeed intrigued, for we thought it well hidden, insignificant among our many realms. Vale lounged in a tavern tent with her men. Her boots up on a table, chair tipped back, she listened to the life bubbling around her, people drinking and chatting, others strolling the path outside, shouting and joking. She enjoyed the warm, enveloping buzz of fellow humans who had turned this tomb of rock into something alive again. It still daunted her to contemplate the size of the tower. How had anyone built a place this big? It could gobble up most cities Vale had seen without having to loosen its belt. Well, best not to think about that. You needed to sneak low beneath all the questions that distracted scribes and scholars. That was the only way to get anything useful done. Instead, she focused on the people. Their voices blended together, and collectively they became a faceless crowd. But the grand thing about people was that you could also choose to focus on particular faces, really see them, and find a wealth of stories. So many people with so many lives, each a separate little mystery. Infinite detail, like pattern. Look close at his fractal lines, and you'd realize each little ridge had an entire architecture of its own. Look close at a given person, and you'd see their uniqueness. See that they didn't quite match whatever broad category you'd first put them in. "So," Red said, talking to Ishna. Vale had brought three of her men today with the spy woman to train them. So Vale could listen, learn, and try to judge if this woman was trustworthy, or if she was some kind of plant. "This is great," Red continued. "But when do we learn the stuff with the knives? Not that I'm eager to kill anyone, just, you know."
"I know what?" Ishna asked.
"Knives are Devi," Red said.
"Devi?" Vale asked, opening her eyes. Red nodded.
"Devi, you know, incredible or neat, but in a smooth way." "Everyone knows that knives are Devi," Gaz added.
Ishna rolled her eyes. The short woman wore her hava with hand covered, and her dress had a light touch of embroidery. Her poise and dress indicated she was a dark-eyed woman of relatively high social standing. Vale drew more attention, and not just because of her white jacket and hat. It was the attention of men assessing whether they wanted to approach her, which they didn't do with Ishna. The way she carried herself, the prim hava, kept them back. Vale sipped her drink, enjoying the wine.
"You've heard lurid stories, I'm sure," Ishna said. "But espionage is not about knives in alleys. I'd barely know what to do with myself if I had to stab someone."
The three men deflated.
"Espionage," Ishna continued, "is about the careful gathering of information. Your task is to observe, but not to be observed. You must be likable enough that people talk to you, but not so interesting that they remember you."
"Well, Gaz is out," Red said.
"Yeah," Gaz said. "It's a curse to be so storming interesting."
"Would you two shut up?" Vatha said.
The lanky soldier had leaned in, cup of cheap wine left untouched.
"How?" he asked. "I'm tall. Gaz has one eye. We'll be remembered."
"You need to learn to channel attention towards superficial traits you can change, and away from traits you cannot. Red, if you wore an eye patch, that detail would stick in their minds. Vathai can teach you how to slouch, so your height isn't noticeable. And if you add an unusual accent, people will describe you by that. Gaz, I could put you in a tavern and have you lie on the table in a feigned drunken stupor. Nobody will notice the eye patch. They'll ignore you as a drunkard. That is beside the point. We must begin with observation. If you are to be useful, you need to be able to make quick assessments of a location, memorize details, and be able to report back. Now, close your eyes."
They reluctantly did so, Vale joining them.
"Now," Ishna said, "can any of you describe the tavern's occupants, without looking, mind you?" Gaz scratched at his eye patch.
"There's a cute one at the bar. She might be Thalen."
"What color is her blouse?"
"Well, it's low cut, and she's grown some nice rock buds. There's this really ugly guy with an eye patch," Red said.
short, annoying type. Drinks your wine when you aren't looking.
Vatha? Ishna asked. What about you?
I think there were some guys at the bar, he said. They were in Sabarial uniforms? And maybe half the tables were occupied. I couldn't say by who.
Better, Ishna said. I didn't expect you to be able to do this. It's human nature to ignore these things. I'll train you, though, so that...
Wait, Vatha said. What about Vale? What does she remember?
3 men at the bar, Vale said absently. Older man with whitening hair and 2 soldiers, probably related, judging by those hooked noses. The younger one is drinking wine. The older one is trying to pick up the woman Gaz noticed. She's not Thalen, but she's wearing Thalen dress with a deep violet blouse and a forest green skirt. I don't like the pairing, but she seems to. She's confident, used to playing with the attention of men. But I think she came here looking for someone because she's ignoring the soldier and keeps glancing over her shoulder. The barkeep is an older man, short enough that he stands on boxes when he fills orders. I bet he hasn't been a barkeep long. He hesitates when someone orders and he has to glance over the bottles, reading their glyphs before he finds the right one. There are 3 barmaids, one is on break, and 14 customers, other than us. She opened her eyes. I can tell you about them.
Won't be necessary, Ishna said as Red clapped softly. Very impressive, Vale. Though I should note that there are 15 other customers, not 14.
Vale started, then glanced around the tent room again, counting, as she'd done in her head just a moment ago. 3 at that table, 4 over there, 2 women standing together by the door, and a woman she'd missed, nestled into a chair by a small table at the back of the tent. She wore simple clothing, a skirt and blouse of Alethi peasant design. Had she intentionally chosen clothing that blended in with the white of the tent and brown of the tables? And what was she doing there? Taking notes, Vale thought with a spike of alarm. The woman had carefully hidden a little notebook in her lap. Who is she? Vale hunkered down. Why is she watching us?
Not us, specifically, Ishna said. There will be dozens like her in the market, moving like rats, gathering what information they can. She might be independent, selling tidbits she finds, but likely she's employed by one of the high princes. That's the job I used to do. I'd guess from the people she's watching that she's been told to gather a report on the mood of the troops.
Vale nodded and listened intently as Ishna started training the men in memory tricks. She suggested they should learn glyphs and use some ploy, like making marks on their hands, to help them keep track of information. Vale had heard of some of these tricks, including the one Ishna talked about, the so-called Mind Museum. Most interesting were Ishna's tips on how to tell what was relevant to report and how to find it. She talked about listening for the names of high princes and for common words used as stand-ins for more important matters, and about how to listen for someone who had just the right amount of drink in them to say things they shouldn't. Tone, she said, was key. You could sit 5 feet from someone sharing important secrets, but miss it because you were focused on the argument at the next table over. The state she described was almost meditative, sitting and letting your ears take in everything, your mind latching on to only certain conversations. Vale found it fascinating. But after about an hour of training, Gaz complained that his head felt like he'd had 4 bottles already. Red was nodding, and the way his eyes were crossed made him seem completely overwhelmed. Vatha, though... He'd closed his eyes and was reeling off descriptions of everyone in the room to Ishna. Vale grinned. For as long as she'd known the man, he'd gone about each of his duties as if he had a boulder tied to his back, slow to move, quick to find a place to sit down and rest. Seeing this enthusiasm from him was encouraging. In fact, Vale was so engaged, she completely missed how much time had passed. When she heard the market bells, she cursed softly. I'm a storming fool.
Vale?
Vatha asked. I've got to get going, she said. Shallan has an appointment. Who would have thought that bearing an ancient divine mantle of power and honor would involve so many meetings?
And she can't make it without you,
Vatha said. Storms, have you watched that girl? She'd forget her feet if they weren't stuck on. Keep practicing. I'll meet up with you later. She pulled on her hat and went dashing through the breakaway. A short time later, Shallan Davar, now safely tucked back into a blue hava, strolled through the hallway beneath Urethiru. She was pleased with the work that Vale was doing with the men, but storms, did she have to drink so much? Shallan burned off practically an entire barrel's worth of alcohol to clear her head. She took a deep breath, then stepped into the former library room. Here she found not only Navani, Yasna, and Teshev, but a host of ardents and scribes. May Aladar, Adratagia from Carbranth. There were even three storm wardens, the odd men with the long beards who liked to predict the weather. Shallan had heard that they would occasionally use the blowing of the winds to foretell the future, but they never offered such services openly. Being near them made Shallan wish for a glyph ward. Vale didn't keep any handy, unfortunately. She was basically a heretic, and thought about religion as often as she did sea silk prices in Ral El Arim. At least Yasna had the backbone to pick a side and announce it. Vale would simply shrug and make some wisecrack. It pattern whispered from her skirt. Shallan? Right. She'd been just standing in the doorway, hadn't she? She walked in, unfortunately passing Yanila, who was acting as Teshev's assistant. The pretty young woman stood with her nose perpetually in the air, and was the type of person whose very enunciation made Shallan's skin crawl. The woman's arrogance was what Shallan didn't like. Not, of course, that Adolin had been courting Yanila soon before meeting Shallan. She'd once tried to avoid Adolin's former romantic partners, but, well, that was like trying to avoid soldiers on a battlefield. They were just kind of everywhere. A dozen conversations buzzed through the room. Talk about weights and measures, the proper placement of punctuation, and the atmosphere variations in the tower. Once she'd have given anything to be in a room like this. Now she was constantly late to the meetings. What had changed? I know how much a fraud I am, she thought, hugging the wall, passing a pretty young ardent discussing Azish politics with one of the storm wardens. Shallan had barely perused those books that Adolin had brought her. On her other side, Navani was talking fabrials with an engineer in a bright red hava. The woman nodded eagerly. Yes, but how to stabilize it, Brightness? With the sails underneath, it will want to spin over, won't it? Shallan's proximity to Navani had offered ample opportunity to study fabrial science. Why hadn't she? As it enveloped her, the ideas, the questions, the logic, she suddenly felt she was drowning, overwhelmed. Everyone in this room knew so much, and she felt insignificant compared to them. I need someone who can handle this, she thought. A scholar. Part of me can become a scholar. Not Vale or Brightness Radiant, but someone... Pattern started humming on her dress again. Shallan backed to the wall. No, this was her, wasn't it? Shallan had always wanted to be a scholar, hadn't she? She didn't need another persona to deal with this, right? Right? The moment of anxiety passed, and she breathed out, forcing herself to steady. Eventually, she pulled a pad of paper and a charcoal pencil out of her satchel, then sought out Yasna and presented herself. Yasna cocked an eyebrow. Late again? Sorry. I intended to ask your help understanding some of the translations we're receiving from the Dawn Chant, but we haven't time before my mother's meeting starts. Maybe I could help you. I have a few items to finish up. We can speak later. an abrupt dismissal, but nothing more than Shallan had come to expect. She walked over to a chair beside the wall and sat down. "Surely," she said softly, "if Yasna had known that I'd just confronted a deep insecurity of mine, she'd have shown some empathy, right?"
"Yasna?" Pattern asked. "I do not think you are paying attention, Shallan. She is not very empathetic."
Shallan sighed.
"You're empathetic, though.
The pathetic part, at least." She steeled herself. "I belong here, Pattern, don't I?"
Yes, of course you do. You'll want to sketch them, right?"
"The classic scholars didn't just draw. The oil sworn knew mathematics. He created the study of ratios in art. Galid was an inventor, and her designs are still used in astronomy today. Sailors couldn't find longitude at sea until the arrival of her clocks. Yasna's a historian, and more. That's what I want."
"Are you sure?"
"I think so." Problem was, Vale wanted to spend her days drinking and laughing with the men, practicing espionage. Radiant wanted to practice with the sword and spend time around Adolin. What did Shallan want? And did it matter? Eventually, Navani called the meeting to order and people took seats. Scribes on one side of Navani, ardents from a variety of devotaries on the other, and far from Yasna. As the storm wardens settled down farther around the ring of seats, Shallan noticed Renarin standing in the doorway. He shuffled, peeking in, but not entering. When several scholars turned toward him, he stepped backward, as if their stares were physically forcing him out. Renarin said.
"Father said I could come. Just listen, maybe."
"You're more than welcome, cousin," Yasna said. She nodded for Shallan to get him a stool, so she did, and didn't even protest being ordered about. She could be a scholar. She'd be the best little ward ever. Head down, Renarin rounded the ring of scholars, keeping a white-knuckled grip on a chain hung from his pocket. As soon as he sat, he started pulling the chain between the fingers of one hand, then the other. Shallan did her best to take notes and not stray into sketching people instead. Fortunately, the proceedings were more interesting than usual. Navani had most of the scholars here working on trying to understand Urithiru. Inadara reported first. She was a wizened scribe who reminded Shallan of her father's ardents, explaining that her team had been trying to ascertain the meaning of the strange shapes of the rooms and tunnels in the tower. She went on at length, talking of defensive constructions, air filtration, and the wells. She pointed out groupings of rooms that were shaped oddly, and of the bizarre murals they'd found, depicting fanciful creatures. When she eventually finished, Calamy reported on her team, who were convinced that certain gold and copper metalworks they'd found embedded in walls were fabrials, but they didn't seem to do anything, even with gems attached. She passed around drawings, then moved on to explaining the efforts, failed so far, they'd taken to try to infuse the gemstone pillar. The only working fabrials were the lifts.
"I suggest,"
interrupted Elthabar, head of the storm wardens,
"that the ratio of the gears used in the lift machinery might be indicative of the nature of those who built it. It is the science of digitology, you see. You can judge much about a man by the width of his fingers."
"And this has to do with gears?"
"How?"
Teshuv asked.
"In every way," Elthabar said. "Why, the fact that you don't know this is a clear indication that you are a scribe. Your writing is pretty, Brightness, but you must give more heed to science."
Pattern buzzed softly. "I never have liked him," Shallan whispered. "He acts nice around Dalinar, but he's quite mean."
"So, which attribute of his are we totaling, and how many people are in the sample size?"
Pattern asked.
"Do you think, maybe," Yanala said, "we are asking the wrong questions?"
Shallan narrowed her eyes, but checked herself, suppressing her jealousy. There was no need to hate someone simply because they'd been close to Adolin. It was just that something felt off about Yanela. Like many women at court, her laughter sounded rehearsed, contained, like they used it as a seasoning rather than actually feeling it.
"What do you mean, child?" Adratagia asked Yanela.
"Well, brightness, we talk about the lifts, the strange fabrial column, the twisting hallways. We try to understand these things merely from their designs. Maybe instead we should figure out the tower's needs and then work backward to determine how these things might have met them."
"Hmm," Navani said. "Well, we know that they grew crops outside. Did some of these wall fabrials provide heat?" Renarin mumbled something. Everyone in the room looked at him. Not a few seemed surprised to hear him speak, and he shrank back.
"What was that, Renarin?" Navani asked. "It's not like that," he said softly. "They're not fabrials. They're a fabrial."
The scribes and scholars shared looks. The prince, well, he often incited such reactions. Discomforted stares.
"Bright Lord," Yanela asked, "are you perhaps secretly an artifabrian, studying engineering by night, reading the women's script?"
Several of the others chuckled. Renarin blushed deeply, lowering his eyes farther.
"You'd never laugh like that at any other man of his rank," Shallan thought, feeling her cheeks grow hot. The Alethi court could be severely polite, but that didn't mean they were nice.
Renarin always had been a more acceptable target than Dalinar or Adolin. Shallan's anger was a strange sensation. On more than one occasion she'd been struck by Renarin's oddness. His presence at this meeting was just another example. Was he thinking of finally joining the Ardents? And he did that by simply showing up at a meeting for scribes, as if he were one of the women? At the same time, how dare Yanela embarrass him?
Navani started to say something, but Shallan cut in.
"Surely, Yanela, you didn't just try to insult the son of the High Prince."
"What?
No, no, of course I didn't."
"Good,"
Shallan said. "Because if you had been trying to insult him, you did a terrible job. And I've heard that you're very clever. So full of wit and charm and other things."
Yanela frowned at her.
"Is that flattery?"
"We weren't talking of your chest, dear. We're speaking of your mind. Your wonderful, brilliant mind. So keen that it's never been sharpened. So quick it's still running when everyone else is done. So dazzling it's never failed to leave everyone in awe at the things you say. So,
Yasna was glaring at her. Shallan held up her notebook.
"I took notes."
"Could we have a short break, Mother?" Yasna asked.
"An excellent suggestion," Navani said. 15 minutes. During which everyone should consider a list of requirements this tower would have, if it were to somehow become self-sufficient."
She rose, and the meeting broke up into individual conversations again.
"I see," Yasna said to Shallan, "that you still use your tongue like a bludgeon rather than a knife."
"Yeah,"
Shallan sighed.
"Any tips?"
Yasna eyed her.
"You heard what she said to Renarin, Brightness?"
"And Mother was about to speak to her about it," Yasna said. "Discreetly, with a judicious word. Instead, you threw a dictionary at her head."
"Sorry. She gets on my nerves."
"Yanela is a fool. Just bright enough to be proud of the wits she has, but stupid enough to be unaware of how outmatched they are."
Yasna rubbed her temples.
"Storms. This is why I never take wards,"
Because they give you so much trouble.
Because I'm bad at it. I have scientific evidence of that fact, and you are but the latest experiment.
Yasna shooed her away, rubbing her temples. Shallan, feeling ashamed, walked to the side of the room while everyone else got refreshments.
Mmm,
Pattern said as Shallan leaned against the wall, notebook held closer to her chest.
Yasna doesn't seem angry. Why are you sad?
Because I'm an idiot, Shallan said, and a fool. And because I don't know what I want. Hadn't it been only a week or two ago that she'd innocently assumed she had it figured out? Whatever it was?
I can see him, said a voice to her side.
Shallan jumped and turned to find Renarin staring at her skirt and the pattern there, which blended into her embroidery. Distinct if you knew to look, but easy to miss.
He doesn't turn invisible? Renarin said.
He says he can't. Renarin nodded, then looked up at her.
Thank you. For? Defending my honor. When Adolin does that, someone usually gets stabbed. Your way was pleasanter.
Well, nobody should take that tone with you. They wouldn't dare do it to Adolin. And besides, you're right. This place is one big fabrile.
You feel it too?
They keep talking about this device or that device, but that's wrong, isn't it? That's like taking the parts of a cart without realizing you've got a cart in the first place.
Shallan leaned in.
That thing we fought, Renarin. It could stretch its tendrils all the way up to the very top of Urethiru. I felt its wrongness wherever I went. That gemstone at the center is tied to everything.
Yes, this isn't only a collection of fabrials. It's many fabrials put together to make one big fabrial.
But what does it do? Shallan asked.
It does being a city.
He frowned.
Well, I mean, it bees a city. It does what the city is.
Shallan shivered. And the Unmade was running it.
Which let us discover this room and the fabrial column, Renarin said. We might not have accomplished that without it. Always look on the bright side.
Logically, Shallan said, the bright side is the only side you can look on because the other side is dark.
Renarin laughed. It brought to mind how her brothers would laugh at what she said. Maybe not because it was the most hilarious thing ever spoken, but because it was good to laugh. That reminded her of what Yasna had said, though, and Shallan found herself glancing at the woman.
I know my cousin is intimidating, Renarin whispered to her. But you're a radiant too, Shallan. Don't forget that. We could stand up to her if we wanted to.
Do we want to? Renarin grimaced.
Probably not. So often she's right, and you just end up feeling like one of the 10 fools.
True, but I don't know if I can stand being ordered around like a child again. I'm starting to feel crazy. What do I do?
Renarin shrugged. I found the best way to avoid doing what Yasna says is to not be around when she's looking for someone to give orders to.
Shallan perked up. That made a lot of sense. Dalinar would need his radiance to go do things, right? She needed to get away, just until she could figure things out. Go somewhere. Like on that mission to Kolinar? Wouldn't they need someone who could sneak into the palace and activate the device?
Renarin, she said, you're a genius.
He blushed, but smiled. Navani called the meeting together again, and they sat to continue discussing fabrials. Yasna tapped Shallan's notebook, and she did a better job of taking the minutes, practicing her shorthand. It wasn't nearly as irksome now as she had an exit strategy, an escape route. She was appreciating that when she noticed a tall figure striding through the door. Dalinar Kolin cast a shadow, even when he wasn't standing in front of the light. Everyone immediately hushed.
Apologies for my tardiness.
He glanced at his wrist and the forearm timepiece that Navani had given him.
Please don't stop because of me.
Dalinar,
Navani asked. You've never attended a meeting of scribes before.
I just thought I should watch, Dalinar said. Learn what this piece of my organization is doing.
He settled down on a stool outside the ring. He looked like a warhorse trying to perch on a stand meant for a show pony. They started up again. Everyone obviously self-conscious. She'd have thought that Dalinar would know to stay away from meetings like this, where women and scribes... Shallan cocked her head as she saw Renarin glance at his father. Dalinar responded with a raised fist. He came so Renarin wouldn't feel awkward, Shallan realized. It can't be improper or feminine for the prince to be here if the storming Blackthorn decides to attend. She didn't miss the way that Renarin actually raised his eyes to watch the rest of the proceedings.
45. A Revelation. As the waves of the sea must continue to surge, so must our will continue resolute. Alone. The Voidbringers carried Moash to Revelar, a city in central Alethkar. Once there, they dropped him outside the city and shoved him toward a group of lesser parchmen. His arms ached from being carried. Why hadn't they used their powers to lash him upward and make him lighter, as Kaladin would have? He stretched his arms, looking around. He'd been to Revelar many times, working a regular caravan to Kolinar. Unfortunately, that didn't mean he'd seen much of the city. Every city of size had a little huddle of buildings on the outskirts for people like him. Modern-day nomads who worked caravans or ran deliveries. The people of the Eves, some had called them. Men and women who hovered close enough to civilization to get out of the weather when it turned bad, but who never really belonged. From the looks of things, Revelar had quite the Eves culture now. Too much of one. The Voidbringers seemed to have taken over the entire storming place, exiling the humans to the outskirts. The Voidbringers left him without a word, despite having lugged him all this distance. The parchmen who took custody of him here looked like a hybrid between Parshendi warriors and the normal, docile parchmen he'd known from many a caravan run. They spoke perfect Alethi as they shoved him toward a group of humans in a little pen. Moash settled in to wait. Looked like the Voidbringers had patrols scouting the area, grabbing human stragglers. Eventually, the parchmen herded him and the others toward one of the large storm bunkers outside the city, used for housing armies or multiple caravans during high storms.
"Don't make trouble," a Parsh woman said, specifically eyeing Moash. "Don't fight or you'll be killed. Don't run or you'll be beaten. You're the slaves now."
Several of the humans, homesteaders from the looks of it, started weeping. They clutched meager bundles, which parchmen searched through. Moash could read the signs of their loss in their reddened eyes and ragged possessions. The Everstorm had wiped out their farm. They'd come to the big city looking for refuge. He had nothing on him of value, not any longer, and the parchmen let him go in before the others. He walked into the bunker, feeling a surreal sense of abandonment? He'd spent the trip here, alternately assuming he'd be executed or interrogated. Instead, they'd made a common slave of him? Even in Sadius's army, he'd never technically been a slave. Assigned to bridge runs, yes. Sent to die. But he'd never worn the brands on his forehead. He felt at the Bridge Four tattoo under his shirt on his left shoulder. The vast high-ceilinged storm bunker was shaped like a huge stone loaf. Moash ambled through it, hands stuffed in his coat pockets. Huddled groups of people regarded him with hostility, even though he was just another refugee. He'd always been met with hostility, no matter where his storming went. A youth like him, too big and obviously too confident for a Dark Eyes, had been considered a threat. He'd joined the caravans to give himself something productive to do, encouraged by his grandparents. They'd been murdered for their kindly ways, and Moash, he'd spent his life putting up with looks like that. A man on his own, a man you couldn't control, was dangerous.
he was inherently frightening, just because of who he was, then nobody would ever let him in. Except Bridge 4. Well, Bridge 4 had been a special case, and he'd failed that test. Graves had been right to tell him to cut the patch off. This was who he really was. The man everyone looked at with distrust, pulling their children tight and nodding for him to move along. He stalked down the middle of the structure, which was so wide it needed pillars to hold up the ceiling. Those rose like trees, soul-cast right into the rock below. The edges of the building were crowded with people, but the center was kept clear and patrolled by armed parshmen. They'd set up stations with wagons as perches where parshmen were addressing crowds. Moash went over to one.
"In case we missed any," the parshmen shouted, "experienced farmers should report to Brew at the front end of the chamber. He will assign you a plot of land to work. Today we also need workers to carry water in the city, and more to clear debris from the last storm. I can take 20 of each."
Men started calling out their willingness, and Moash frowned, leaning toward a man nearby. "They offer us work? Aren't we slaves?"
"Yeah," the man said. "Slaves who don't eat unless they work. They let us choose what we want to do, though it's not much of a storming choice, one kind of drudgery or another."
With a start, Moash realized that the man had pale green eyes. Yet he still raised his hand and volunteered to carry water, something that had once been parshmen work. Well, that was a sight that couldn't help but brighten a man's day. Moash shoved hands back in pockets and continued through the room, checking each of the three stations where parshmen offered jobs. Something about these parshmen and their perfect alethi unsettled him. The Voidbringers were what he'd expected, with their alien accents and dramatic powers. But the ordinary parshmen, many of them looked like Parshendi now, with those taller builds, seemed almost as bewildered at their reversal in fortune as the humans were. Each of the three stations dealt with a different category of labor. The one at the far end was looking for farmers, women with sewing skill, and cobblers. Food, uniforms, boots. The parshmen were preparing for war. Asking around, Moash learned they'd already grabbed the smiths, fletchers, and armorers, and if you were found hiding skill in any of these three, your whole family would be put on half rations. The middle station was for basic labor, hauling water, cleaning, cooking food. The last station was the most interesting to Moash. This was for hard labor. He lingered here, listening to a parshman ask for volunteers to pull wagons of supplies with the army when it marched. Apparently, there weren't enough chulls to move wagons for what was coming. Nobody raised their hands for this one. It sounded like ghastly work, not to mention the fact that it would mean marching toward battle. "They'll need to press the people into this," Moash thought. "Maybe they can round up some light eyes and make them trudge across the rock like beasts of burden. He'd like to see that." As he left this last station, Moash spotted a group of men with long staffs leaning against the wall. Sturdy boots, water skins and holsters tied to their thighs, and a walking kit sewn into the trousers on the other side. He knew from experience what that would carry. A bowl, spoon, cup, thread, needle, patches, and some flint and tinder. Caravaneers. The long staffs were for slapping chull shells while walking beside them. He'd worn an outfit like that many times, though many of the caravans he'd worked had used parshmen to pull wagons instead of chulls. They were faster.
"Hey,"
he said, strolling over to the caravaneers. "Is Guff still around?"
"Guff?"
one of the caravaneers said.
"Old wheelwright, half a reed tall, bad at cussing?"
"That's him." "I think he's over there," the young man said, pointing with his staff.
"In the tents. But there ain't work, friend." "The shellheads are marching," Moash said, thumbing over his shoulder. "They'll need caravaneers." "Positions are full," another of the men said. "There was a fight to see who got those jobs. Everyone else will be pulling wagons. Don't draw too much attention or they'll slap a harness on you, mark my words."
They smiled in a friendly way to Moash, and he gave them an old caravanner's salute, close enough to a rude gesture that everyone else mistook it, and strode in the direction they'd pointed. Typical. Caravaneers were a big family and, like a family, prone to squabbling. The tents were really some sections of cloth that had been stretched from the wall to poles driven into buckets of rocks to keep them steady. That made a kind of tunnel along the wall here, and underneath a lot of older people coughed and sniffled. It was dim, with only the occasional chip on an overturned box giving light. He picked out the caravaneers by their accents. He asked after Guff, who was one of the men he'd known back in the day and was allowed to penetrate deeper along the shadowy tent tunnel. Eventually, Moash found old Guff sitting right in the middle of the tunnel, as if to keep people from going farther. He had been sanding a piece of wood, an axle by the looks of it. He squinted as Moash stepped up.
"Moash," he said. "Really? What storm and storm brought you here?"
"You wouldn't believe me if I told you," Moash said, squatting down beside the old man.
"You were on Jam's caravan," Guff said. "Off to the Shattered Plains. Gave you all up for dead. Wouldn't have bet a dun chip on you returning."
"A wise enough bet," Moash said. He hunched forward, resting his arms on his knees. In this tunnel, the buzz of people outside seemed a distant thing, though only cloth separated them.
"Son?" Guff asked. "Why are you here, boy? What do you want?"
"I just need to be who I was."
"That makes as much sense as the Storm and Stormfather playing the flute, boy. But you wouldn't be the first to go off to those plains and come back not all right." "No, you wouldn't. That's the Stormfather's storming own truth, that storming is."
"They tried to break me. Damnation, they did break me. But then he made me again. A new man."
Moash paused.
"I threw it all away."
"Sure. Sure," Guff said.
"I always do that," Moash whispered. "Why must we always take something precious, Guff, and find ourselves hating it? As if by being pure it reminds us of just how little we deserve it. I held the spear, and I stabbed myself with it."
"The spear?" Guff asked. "Boy, you a Stormin' soldier?"
Moash looked at him with a start, then stood up, stretching, showing his patchless uniform coat. Guff squinted in the darkness.
"Come with me."
The old wheelwright rose, with difficulty, and set his piece of wood on his chair. He led Moash with a rickety gait farther into the cloth tunnel, and they entered a portion of the tented area that was more room-like, the far corner of the large bunker. Here, a group of maybe a dozen people sat in furtive conversation, chairs pulled together. A man at the door grabbed Guff by the arm as he shuffled in.
"Guff, you're supposed to be on guard, fool man." "I'm storming on storming guard, you pisser," Guff said, shaking his arm free. "The Bright wanted to know if we found any soldiers. Well, I found a storming soldier, so storm off."
The guard turned his attention to Moash, then flicked his eyes to Moash's shoulder.
"Deserter?"
Moash nodded. It was true in more ways than one.
"What's this?"
One of the men stood up, a tall fellow. Something about his silhouette, that bald head, that cut of clothing.
"Deserter, Bright Lord,"
the guard said.
"From the Shattered Plains,"
Guff added. "The High Lord," Moash realized. "Paladar. Bama's kinsman and regent, a notoriously harsh man. In years past, he had nearly run the city to the ground, driving away many dark eyes who had the right of travel. Not a caravan had passed when someone hadn't complained about Paladar's greed and corruption."
"From the Shattered Plains, you say?"
Paladar said.
"Excellent. Tell me, deserter, what news is there from the High Princes? Do they know of my plight here? Can I expect aid soon?"
"They put him in charge," Moash thought, spotting other light eyes. They wore fine clothing, not silks, of course, but well-trimmed uniforms, exceptional boots. There was food aplenty set out at the side of this chamber, while those outside scrounged and did heavy labor. He'd begun to hope, but of course that had been stupid. The arrival of the Voidbringers hadn't cast the light eyes down. The few Moash had seen outside were merely the sacrifices. The fawning dark eyes at the periphery confirmed this. Soldiers, guards, some favored merchants. To damnation with them. They'd been given a chance to escape from the light eyes, and it had only made them more eager to be servants. In that moment, surrounded by the pettiness that was his own kind, Moash had a revelation. He wasn't broken. All of them were broken. A Lethe society, light-eyed and dark. Maybe all of humankind.
"Well?" the regent demanded. "Speak up, man."
Moash remained silent, overwhelmed. He wasn't the exception, always ruining what he was given. Men like Kaladin were the exception. The very, very rare exception. These people proved it. There was no reason to obey Light Eyes. They had no power, no authority. Men had taken opportunity and cast it to the Krem.
I think there's something wrong with him, Bright Lord, the guard said.
Yeah, Guff added. Should maybe have mentioned he's Stormin' Strange in the head now, Stormin' Pisser.
Bah, the regent said, pointing at Moash. Have that one thrown out. We haven't time for foolishness if we are to restore my place.
He pointed at Guff.
Have that one beaten, and post a competent guard next time, Ked, or you'll be next.
Old Guff cried out as they seized him. Moash just nodded. Yes, of course. That was what they would do. The guards took him under the arms and dragged him to the side of the tent. They parted the cloth and hauled him out. They passed a frazzled woman trying to divide a single piece of flatbread between three young crying children. You could probably hear their weeping from the Bright Lord's tent, where he had a stack of bread piled high. The guards threw him back out into the street that ran down the middle of the large bunker. They told him to stay away, but Moash barely heard. He picked himself up, dusted himself off, then walked to the third of the workstations, the one seeking hard laborers. There he volunteered for the most difficult job they had, pulling wagons of supplies for the Voidbringer army. 46. When the Dream Dies. Did you expect anything else from us? We need not suffer the interference of another. Race is contained, and we care not for his prison. Scar the Bridgeman ran up one of the ramps outside Urethiru, breath puffing in the cold air as he silently counted his steps to maintain focus. The air was thinner up here at Urethiru, and that made running harder, though he really only noticed it outside. He wore full marching pack and gear, rations, equipment, helmet, jerkin, and a shield tied to the back. He carried his spear and even had some greaves stuck to his legs, held in place by the shape of the metal. All of that weighed almost as much as he did. He finally hit the top of the Oathgate platform. Storms, but the center building looked farther away than he remembered. He tried to pick up his pace anyway and jogged for all he was worth, the pack clinking. Finally, sweating, breath growing ragged, he reached the control building and dashed inside. He finally pulled to a stop, dropping his spear and resting his hands on his knees, gasping for breath. Most of Bridge 4 waited here, some glowing with stormlight. Of them all, Scar was the only one who, despite 2 weeks of practice, still hadn't figured out how to draw it in. Well, except for Dabbit and Relaine. Sigzel checked the clock they'd been allocated by Navani Kolin, a device the size of a small box.
"That was about 10 minutes," he said. "Just under."
Scar nodded, wiping his brow. He'd run over a mile from the center of the market, then crossed the plateau and charged the ramp. Storms. He'd pushed himself too hard.
How long, he said, gasping. How long did it take Drahi? The two had set out together. Sigzil glanced at the tall, muscled bridgeman who still glowed with residual stormlight.
Under 6 minutes.
Scar groaned, sitting down.
The Bislan is equally important, Scar, Sigzil said, making glyphs in his notebook. We need to know a normal man's abilities to make comparisons. Don't worry, though. I'm sure you'll figure out Stormlight soon.
Scar flopped backward, looking up. Lopan was walking around on the ceiling of the room, storming Herr Dazian.
Drahi, you used a quarter of a basic lashing by Kaladin's terminology?
Sigzil continued, still making notes.
Yeah, Drahi said. I know the precise amount, Sig. Strange.
Which made you half as heavy as usual when we put you on the scale back in the rooms. But why does a quarter lashing make you half as heavy? Shouldn't it make you 25% as heavy?
Does it matter? Drahi asked.
Sigzil looked at him as if he were crazy.
Of course it does.
I want to try a lashing at an angle next, Drahi said. See if I can make it feel like I'm running downhill, no matter which direction I go. Might not need it. Holding Stormlight, it made me feel like I could run forever.
Well, it's a new record, Sigzil mumbled, still writing. You beat Lopin's time.
Did he beat mine?
Leighton called from the side of the room where he was inspecting the tiling on the floor.
You stopped for food on the way, Leighton, Sigzil said. Even Rock beat your time, and he was skipping like a girl the last third.
Was horny the dance of victory, Rock said from near Leighton. Is very manly.
Manly or not, it threw off my test, Sigzil said. At least Scar is willing to pay attention to proper procedure.
Scar remained lying on the ground as the others chatted. Kaladin was supposed to come and transport them to the shattered plains, and Sigzil had decided to run some tests. Kaladin, as usual, was late. Teft sat down next to Scar, inspecting him with dark green eyes with bags underneath. Kaladin had named the two of them lieutenants, along with Rock and Sigzil, but their roles had never really settled into that ranking. Teft was the perfect definition of a platoon sergeant.
Here, Teft said, handing over a chowta,
meatballs wrapped in flatbread, Herdazian style.
Leighton brought food. Eat something, lad.
Scar forced himself to sit up.
I'm not that much younger than you, Teft. I'm hardly a lad.
Teft nodded to himself, chewing on his own chowder. Finally, Scar started into his. It was good, not spicy like a lot of Alethi food, but still good. Flavorful.
Everyone keeps telling me that I'll get it soon, Scar said. But what if I don't? There won't be room in the Windrunners for our lieutenant who has to walk everywhere. I'll end up cooking lunch with Rock. Ain't nothing wrong with being on the support team. Pardon, Sarge, but storm that. Do you know how long I waited to hold a spear?
Scar picked up the weapon from beside his pack and laid it across his lap.
I'm good at it. I can fight, only...
Lopin left the ceiling, rotating to get his legs under him and floating gently to the floor. He laughed as Bissig, in turn, tried flying up to the ceiling and crashed headfirst into it. Bissig hopped to his feet, looking down at them all, embarrassed. But what did he have to be embarrassed about? He was standing on the ceiling.
You were in the military before, Teft guessed.
No, but not for lack of trying. You heard of the Black Caps?
Aladar's personal guards?
Let's just say they didn't think much of my application.
Yes, we let dark eyes in, but not runts.
Teft grunted, chewing on his chowder.
Said they might reconsider if I equipped myself, Scar said. Do you know how much armor costs? I was a stupid rock splitter with visions of battlefield glory.
It used to be they'd never speak about their pasts. That had changed, though Scar couldn't specify exactly when. It came out as part of the catharsis of having become something greater. Teft was an addict,
Drahi had struck an officer. Eth had been caught planning to desert with his brother. Even simple Haber had been part of a drunken brawl. Knowing Haber, he'd probably only gone along with what his squad was doing, but a man had ended up dead.
"You'd think," Teft said, "that our high and mighty leader would have gotten here by now. I swear Kaladin acts more like a light eyes every day."
"Don't let him hear you say that," Scar said.
"I'll say what I want," Teft snapped. "If that boy's not going to come, maybe I should be going. I have things to do."
Scar hesitated, glancing up at Teft.
"Not that," Teft growled. "I barely touched the stuff in days. You'd think a man had never had a wild night out the way you're all treating me."
"Didn't say a thing, Teft."
"Knowing what we've suffered, it's insane to think that we wouldn't need something to get us through the day. The moss isn't the problem. It's the storming world going all crazy. That's the problem."
"Sure is, Teft." Teft eyed him, then studied his chowder roll intently.
So, how long have the men known? I mean, did anyone—"
"Not long," Scar said quickly. "Nobody's even thinking about it." Teft nodded and didn't see through the lie. Truth was, most of them had noticed Teft sneaking off to grind a little moss now and then. It wasn't uncommon in the army. But doing what he'd done, missing duty, selling his uniform, ending up in an alley, that was different. It was the sort of thing that could get you discharged at best. At worst, well, it might get you assigned to bridge duty. Trouble was, they weren't common soldiers anymore. They weren't light eyes, either. They were something strange, something that nobody understood.
"I don't want to talk about this," Teft said.
"Look, weren't we discussing how to get you to glow?
That's the problem at hand."
Before he could press further, Kaladin Stormblessed finally deigned to arrive, bringing with him the scouts and hopefuls from other bridge crews who had been trying to draw in Stormlight. So far, nobody except men from Bridge 4 had managed it, but that included a few that had never actually run bridges. Huio and Punio, Lopin's cousins, and men like Cohen, from the old Cobalt Guard who had been recruited into Bridge 4 a couple months back. So there was still hope that others could manage it. Kaladin had brought roughly 30 people, beyond those who had already been training with the team. Judging by their uniform patches, this 30 had come from other divisions, and some were light-eyed. Kaladin had mentioned asking General Kahl to round up the most promising potential recruits from throughout the Eleathi army.
"All here," Kaladin said. "Good."
He strode to the side of the single-roomed control building, a sack of glowing gemstones slung over his shoulder. His magnificent shard blade appeared in his hand, and he slid it into the keyhole in the chamber wall. Kaladin engaged the ancient mechanism, pushing the sword, and the entire inner wall, which could rotate, toward a specific point marked by murals. The floor began to glow, and outside Stormlight rose in a swirl around the entire stone plateau. Kaladin locked the blade into place at the mark on the floor designated the Shattered Plains. When the glow faded, they'd come to Narak. Sigzil left his pack and armor leaning against the wall and strode out. Best they could determine, the entire stone top of the platform had come with them, swapping places with the one that had been out here. At the platform edge, a group of people climbed across a ramp to meet them. A short Alethi woman named Ristina counted out the bridgemen and soldiers as they passed, marking on her ledger.
"Took you long enough, Bright Lord," she noted to Kaladin, whose eyes glowed faintly blue. "The merchants were beginning to complain."
It took Stormlight to power the device. Some of the gemstones in Kaladin's sack would have been drained by the process. But curiously, it didn't take much more to swap two groups than it did to travel one way. So they tried to run the oath gates when they had people on both sides wanting to exchange places. "Tell merchants when they next come through," Kaladin said, "that the Knights Radiant are not their doormen. They'll want to accustom themselves to waiting unless they find a way to swear the oaths themselves."
Christina smirked and wrote it down as if she were going to pass on that exact message. Scar smiled at that. Nice to see a scribe with a sense of humor. Kaladin led the way through the city of Narak, once a Parshendi stronghold, now an increasingly important human way stop between the war camps and Urethiru. The buildings here were surprisingly sturdy, well-constructed of krem and carved great-shell carapace. Scar had always assumed the Parshendi to be like the nomads who roved between Aesir and Yakabed. He imagined Parshendi who were wild and ferocious, without civilization, hiding in caves for storms. Yet here was a well-built, carefully laid-out city. They'd found a building full of artwork of a style that baffled the Alethi scribes. Parshman art. They'd been painting even while they fought a war. Just like, well, just like ordinary people. He glanced at Shen. No, Relaine. It was hard to remember. Walking with spear to his shoulder. Scar forgot he was there most of the time, and that made him ashamed. Relaine was as much a member of Bridge Four as anyone else, right? Would he rather have been painting than fighting? They passed sentry posts full of Dalinar's soldiers, along with many in red and light blue. Ruthar's colors. Dalinar was putting some of the other soldiers to work, trying to prevent more dust-ups between soldiers from different princedoms. Without the fighting on the shattered plains to keep them focused, the men were getting restless. They passed a large group of soldiers practicing with bridges on a nearby plateau. Scar couldn't hold back a grin as he saw their black uniforms and helms. Plateau runs had been started again, but with more structure, and the spoils were shared equally among the high princes. Today it was the Black Cap's turn. Scar wondered if any of them would recognize him. Probably not, even if he had caused quite a ruckus among them. There had been only one logical way to get the equipment he needed for his application. He'd stolen it from the Black Cap quartermaster. Scar had thought they would praise his ingenuity. He was so eager to be a Black Cap that he'd go to great lengths to join them, right? Wrong. His reward had been a slave brand and eventual sale to Sadius's army. He brushed his fingers across the scars on his forehead. Stormlight had healed the brands of the other men. They'd covered them all up with tattoos anyway. But it seemed another little dig, dividing him from the others. Right now, he was the only fighting man in Bridge Four who still had his slave brand. Well, him and Kaladin, whose scars wouldn't heal for some reason. They reached the training plateau, crossing the old Bridge Four, which was held in place with some soul-cast rock guideposts. Kaladin called a meeting of the officers as several of Rock's children set up a water station. The tall horn-eater seemed beyond enthused to have his family working with him. Scar joined Kaladin, Sigzel, Teft, and Rock. Though they stood close, there was a conspicuous gap where Moash should have been. It felt so wrong to have a member of Bridge Four completely unaccounted for, and Kaladin's silence on the topic hung over them like an executioner's axe. "I'm worried," Kaladin said, "that nobody practicing with us has begun breathing stormlight."
"It's only been 2 weeks, sir," Sigzel said.
"True, but still thinks several feel right, though she won't tell me who, as she says it would be wrong." Kaladin gestured toward the newcomers. "I asked Kahl to send me another batch of hopefuls because I figured the more people we had, the better our chances of finding new squires." He paused. "I didn't specify they couldn't be light-eyed. Perhaps I should have."
"Don't see why, sir," Scar said, pointing. "That's Captain Kolat. Good man. He helped us explore.
Just wouldn't feel right having light-eyed men in Bridge Four."
"Other than you?" Scar asked. "And Renarin? And, well, any of us who earn our own blades, and maybe Rock, who I think might have been light-eyed among his people, even if he has dark—"
"Fine, Scar," Kaladin said. "Point made. Anyway, we don't have a lot of time left before I leave for Elokar. I'd like to push the recruits harder, see if they're likely to be able to swear the oaths. Any thoughts?"
"Shove them off edge of plateau," Rock said. "Those who fly, We let in.
Any serious suggestions? Kaladin asked.
Let me run them through some formations, Teft said.
A good idea, Kaladin said. Storms, I wish we knew how the Radiants used to handle expansion. Were there recruitment drives, or did they just wait until someone attracted a Spren?
I wouldn't make them a squire, though, Teft said, rubbing his chin. But a full Radiant, right?
A valid point, Sigsel said. We have no proof that we squires are a step toward becoming full Radiants. We might always be your support team, and in that case it's not individual skill that matters, but your decision. Maybe that of your Spren. You choose them, they serve under you, and then they start drawing in Stormlight.
Yeah, Scar said, uncomfortable. They all glanced at him. The first of you that says something placating, Scar said, gets a fist in the face. Or the stomach if I can't reach your Stormin' stupid horn-eater face.
Rock said. You could hit my face, Scar. I have seen you jump very high. Almost you seem as tall as regular person when you do that.
Teft, Kaladin said. Go ahead and run those potential recruits through formations, and tell the rest of the men to watch the sky. I'm worried about more raids on the caravans. He shook his head. Something about those raids doesn't add up. The war camp's parshmen, by all reports, have marched to Alethkar. But why would those fused keep harrying us? They won't have the troops to take advantage of any supply problems they cause. Scar shared a glance with Sigsel, who shrugged. Kaladin talked like this sometimes, differently from the rest of them. He'd trained them in formations in the spear, and they could proudly call themselves soldiers. But they'd only actually fought a few times. What did they know of things like strategy and battlefield tactics?
They broke, Teft jogging off to drill the potential recruits. Kaladin set Bridge Four to studying their flying. They practiced landings and then did sprints in the air, zipping back and forth in formation, getting used to changing directions quickly. It was a little distracting, seeing those glowing lines of light shoot through the sky. Scar attended Kaladin as he observed the recruits doing formations. The Light Eyes didn't voice a single complaint about being filed into ranks with Dark Eyes. Kaladin and Teft, well, all of them really, had a tendency to act as if every light-eyed man was in some way regal. But there were far, far more of them who did normal jobs, though granted they got paid better for those jobs than a dark-eyed man did. Kaladin watched, then glanced at the Bridge Foreman in the sky.
I wonder, Scar, he said, how important are formations going to be for us, going forward? Can we devise new ones to use in flying? Everything changes when your enemy can attack from all sides.
After about an hour, Scar went for water and enjoyed some good-natured ribbing from the others who landed to grab something to drink. He didn't mind. What you had to watch out for was when Bridge Four didn't torment you. The others took off a short time later, and Scar watched them go, launching into the sky. He took a long draft of Rock's current refreshment. He called it tea, but it tasted like boiled grain, and found himself feeling useless. Were these people, these new recruits, going to start glowing and take his place in Bridge Four? Would he be shuffled off to other duties while someone else laughed with the crew and got ribbed for their height?
Storm it, he thought, tossing aside his cup. I hate feeling sorry for myself.
He hadn't sulked when the Black Caps had turned him down, and he wouldn't sulk now. He was fishing in his pocket for gemstones, determined to practice some more, when he spotted Lynn sitting on a rock nearby, watching the recruits run formations. She was slouching, and he read frustration in her posture. Well, he knew that feeling. Scar shouldered his spear and sauntered over. The four other scout women had gone to the water station. Rock let out a bellowing laugh at what one of them said.
Not joining in? Scar asked,
nodding toward the new recruits marching past.
I don't know formations, Scar. I've never done drills, never even held a storming spear. I ran messages and scouted the plains.
She sighed.
I didn't pick it up fast enough, did I? He's gone and gotten some new people to test since I failed.
Don't be stupid, Scar said, sitting beside her on the large rock.
You're not being forced out. Kaladin just wants to have as many potential recruits as possible. She shook her head. Everyone knows that we're in a new world now, a world where rank and eye color don't matter. Something glorious. She looked up at the sky and the men training there. I want to be part of it, Scar. So badly. Yeah. She looked at him, probably saw it in his eyes, that same emotion. Storms. I hadn't even thought, Scar. Must be worse for you. He shrugged and reached into his pouch, taking out an emerald as big as his thumb. It shone fiercely, even in the bright daylight. You ever hear about the first time Captain Stormblessed drew in light? He told us. That day after he knew he could do it because Tef told him, and not that day. You mean while he was healing, she said, after the high storm where he was strung up? Not that day either, Scar said, holding up the gemstone. Through it he saw men running formations and imagined them carrying a bridge. I was there, second row, bridge run, bad one. We were charging the plateau and a lot of Parshendi had set up. They dropped most of the first row, all but Kaladin. That exposed me, right beside him, second row. In those days you didn't have good odds running near the front. The Parshendi wanted to take down our bridge and they focused their shots on us, on me. I knew I was dead. I knew it. I saw the arrows coming, and I breathed a last prayer, hoping the next life wouldn't be quite so bad. Then the arrows moved, Lin. They storming swerved toward Kaladin. He turned the emerald over and shook his head. There's a special lashing you can do, which makes things curve in the air. Kaladin painted the wood above his hands with stormlight and drew the arrows toward him instead of me. That's the first time I can say I knew something special was happening. He lowered the gemstone and pressed it into her hand. Back then, Kaladin did it without even knowing what he was doing. Maybe we're just trying too hard, you know? But it doesn't make sense. They say you have to suck it in. What does that even mean? No idea, Scar said. They each describe it differently, and it's breaking my brain trying to figure it out. They talk about a sharp intake of breath, only not really for breathing. Which is perfectly clear. Tell me about it, Scar said, tapping the gemstone in her palm. It worked best for Kaladin when he didn't stress. It was harder when he focused on making it happen. So I'm supposed to accidentally but deliberately breathe something in without breathing, but not try too hard at it? Doesn't it just make you want to string up the lot of them in the storms? But their advice is all we got, so... She looked at the stone, then held it close to her face. That didn't seem to be important, but what could it hurt? And breathed in. Nothing happened. So she tried again, and again, for a solid 10 minutes. I don't know, Scar, she finally said, lowering the stone. I keep thinking maybe I don't belong here. If you haven't noticed, none of the women have managed this. I kind of forced my way among you all, and nobody asked. Stop, he said, taking the emerald and holding it before her again. Stop right there. You want to be a windrunner?
More than anything, she whispered.
Why?
Because I want to soar.
Not good enough. Kaladin. He wasn't thinking about being left out or how great it would be to fly. He was thinking about saving the rest of us. Saving me. Why do you want to be in the Windrunners?
Because I want to help. I want to do something other than stand around waiting for the enemy to come to us.
Well, you have a chance, Lin. A chance nobody has had for ages. A chance in millions. Either you seize it, and in so doing decide you're worthy, or you leave and give up.
He pressed the gemstone back down into her hand. But if you leave, you don't get to complain. As long as you keep trying, there's a chance. When you give up, that's when the dream dies.
She met his eyes, closed her fist around the gemstone, and breathed in with a sharp, distinct breath. Then started glowing.
She yelped in surprise and opened her hand to find the gemstone within done. She looked at him in awe.
What did you do?
Nothing, Scar said, which was the problem. Still, he found he couldn't be jealous. Maybe this was his lot, helping others become radiants. A trainer? A facilitator? Teft saw Lynn glowing, then dashed over and started cursing. But they were good Teft curses. He grabbed her by the arm and towed her toward Kaladin. Scar took in a long, satisfied breath. Well, that was two he'd helped so far, counting Rock. He could live with that, couldn't he? He strolled over to the drink station and got another cup.
What is this foul stuff, Rock? He asked. You didn't mistake the washing water for tea, did you?
His old Horn-Eater recipe, he said, has proud tradition.
Like skipping?
Like formal war dance, he said, and hitting annoying bridgemen on head for not showing proper respect.
Scar turned around and leaned one hand on the table, watching Lynn's enthusiasm as her squad of scouts ran up to her. He felt good about what he'd done. Strangely good. Excited, even.
I think I'm going to have to get used to smelly Horn-Eater's Rock, Scar said. I'm thinking of joining your support team.
You think I will let you anywhere near Cookpot?
I might not ever learn to fly.
He squished the part of him that whimpered at that.
I need to come to terms with the fact, so I'll have to find another way to help out.
Ha! And the fact that you are glowing with stormlight right now is not at all consideration in decision?
Scar froze. Then he focused on his hand, right in front of his face, holding a cup. Tiny wisps of stormlight curled off it. He dropped the cup with a cry, digging from his pocket a couple of dun chips. He'd given his practice gemstone to Lynn. He looked up at Rock, then grinned stupidly.
I suppose, Rock said, I can maybe have you wash dishes, though you do keep throwing my cups on the ground. It's not proper respect at all.
He trailed off as Scar left him, running for the others and whooping with excitement.
47. So much is lost. Indeed, we admire his initiative. Perhaps if you had approached the correct one of us with your plea, it would have found favorable audience.
I am Talanel Elin, herald of war. The time of the return, the desolation is near at hand. We must prepare. You will have forgotten much following the destruction of the times past. Kalak will teach you to cast bronze, if you have forgotten this. We will soul-cast blocks of metal directly for you. I wish we could teach you steel, but casting is so much easier than forging, and you must have something we can produce quickly. Your stone tools will not serve against what is to come. Videl can train your surgeons, and Jezrian will teach you leadership. So much is lost between returns. I will train your soldiers. We should have time. Ishar keeps talking about a way to keep information from being lost following desolations. And you have discovered something unexpected. We will use that. Surge binders to act as guardians. Knights. The coming days will be difficult. But with training, humanity will survive. You must bring me to your leaders. The other heralds should join us soon. I think I am late this time. I fear, oh God, that I have failed. No, this is not right, is it? How long has it been? Where am I? I am Talanel Elin, herald of war. The time of the return, the desolation is near at hand.
Yasna trembled as she read the madman's words. She turned over the sheet and found the next one covered in similar ideas, repeated over and over. This couldn't be a coincidence, and the words were too specific. The abandoned herald had come to Kolinar, and had been dismissed as a madman. She leaned back in her seat, and Ivory, full-sized, like a human, stepped over to the table. Hands clasped behind his back, he wore his usual stiff, formal suit. The Spren's coloring was jet black, both clothing and features, though something prismatic swirled on his skin. It was as if pure black marble had been coated in oil that glistened with hidden color. He rubbed his chin, reading the words. Yasna had rejected the nice rooms with balconies on the rim of Urethiru. Those had such an obvious entrance for assassins or spies. Her small room at the center of Dalinar's section was far more secure. She had stuffed the ventilation openings with cloth. The airflow from the hallway outside was adequate for this room, and she wanted to make sure nobody could overhear her by listening through the shafts. In the corner of her room, three span reeds worked tirelessly. She had rented them at great expense until she could acquire new ones of her own. They were paired with reeds in Tushik that had been delivered to one of the finest and most trustworthy information centers in the princedom. There, miles and miles away, a scribe was carefully rewriting each page of her notes, which she had originally sent to them to keep safe. "This speaker, Yasna," Ivory said, tapping the sheet she'd just read. Ivory had a clipped, no-nonsense voice. "This one who said these words. This person is a herald. Our suspicions are true. The heralds are, and the fallen one still is." "We need to find him," Yasna said. "We must search Shadesmar," Ivory said. "In this world, men can hide easily. But their souls shine out to us on the other side, unless someone knows how to hide them." Ivory looked toward the growing stack of notes in the corner. One of the pens had finished writing. Yasna rose to change the paper. Shallan had rescued one of her trunks of notes, but two others had gone down with the sinking ship. Fortunately, Yasna had sent off these backup copies. Or did it matter? This sheet, encrypted by her cipher, contained lines and lines of information connecting the parchment to the Voidbringers. Once, she'd slaved over each of these passages, teasing them from history. Now their contents were common knowledge. In one moment, all of her expertise had been wiped away. "We've lost so much time," she said. "Yes. We must catch what we have lost, Yasna. We must." "The enemy?" Yasna asked. "He stirs. He angers." Ivory shook his head, kneeling beside her as he changed the sheets of paper. "We are not before him, Yasna. He would destroy my kind and yours." The spanreed finished, and another started writing out the first lines of her memoirs, which she'd worked on intermittently throughout her life. She'd thrown aside a dozen different attempts, and as she read this latest one, she found herself disliking it as well. "What do you think of Shallan?" she asked Ivory, shaking her head. "The person she's become." Ivory frowned, lips drawing tight. His sharply chiseled features, too angular to be human, were like those of a roughed-out statue the sculptor had neglected to finish. "She is troubling," he said. "That much hasn't changed. She is not stable." "Ivory, you think all humans are unstable." "Not you," he said, lifting his chin. "You are like a Spren. You think by facts. You change not on simple whims. You are as you are." She gave him a flat stare. "Mostly," he added. "Mostly. But it is Yasna. Compared to other humans, you are practically a stone." She sighed, standing up and brushing past him, returning to her writing desk. The herald's ravings glared at her. She settled down, feeling tired. "Yasna," Ivory asked, "am I in error?"
"I am not so much a stone as you think, Ivory. Sometimes I wish I were."
"These words trouble you," he said, stepping up to her again and resting his jet-black fingers on the paper. "Why? You have read many troubling things. Yasna settled back, listening to the three spanreeds scratching paper, writing out notes that, she feared, would mostly be irrelevant. Something stirred deep within her. Glimmers of memory from a dark room, screaming her voice ragged. A childhood illness nobody else seemed to remember for all it had done to her. It had taught her that people she loved could still hurt her. Have you ever wondered how it would feel to lose your sanity, Ivory? Ivory nodded. I have wondered at this. How could I not? Considering what the ancient fathers are. You call me logical, whispered Yasna. It's untrue, as I let my passions rule me as much as many. In my times of peace, however, my mind has always been the one thing I could rely upon. Except once. She shook her head, picking up the paper again. I fear losing that, Ivory. It terrifies me. How would it have felt to be these heralds? To suffer your mind slowly becoming untrustworthy? Are they too far gone to know? Or are there lucid moments where they strain and sort through memories, trying frantically to decide which are reliable and which are fabrications? She shivered. The ancient ones, Ivory said again, nodding. He didn't often speak of the Spren who had been lost during the recreants. Ivory and his fellows had been mere children, well, the Spren equivalent, at the time. They spent years, centuries, with no older Spren to nurture and guide them. The Ink Spren were only now beginning to recover the culture and society they had lost when men abandoned their vows. Your ward, Ivory said. Her Spren. A cryptic. Which is bad? Ivory nodded. He preferred simple, straightforward gestures. You never saw Ivory shrug. Cryptics are trouble. They enjoy lies, Yasna. Feast upon them. Speak one word untrue at a gathering, and seven cluster around you. Their humming fills your ears. Have you warred with them? One does not war with cryptics, as one does honor Spren. Cryptics have but one city, and do not wish to rule more, only to listen. He tapped the table. Perhaps this one is better with the bond. Ivory was the only new generation Ink Spren to form a radiant bond. Some of his fellows would rather have killed Yasna instead of letting him risk what he had done. The Spren had a noble air about him, stiff-backed and commanding. He could change his size at will, but not his shape, except when fully in this realm, manifesting as a shard blade. He had taken the name Ivory as a symbol of defiance. He was not what his kin said he was, and would not suffer what fate proclaimed. The difference between a higher Spren like him and a common emotion Spren was in their ability to decide how to act. A living contradiction, like human beings. Shallan won't listen to me any longer, Yasna said. She rebels against every little thing I tell her. These last few months on her own have changed the child. She never obeyed well, Yasna. That is who she is. In the past, at least, she pretended to care about my teaching. But you have said more humans should question their places in life. Did you not say that they too often accept presumed truth as fact? She tapped the table. You're right, of course. Wouldn't I rather have her straining against her boundaries as opposed to happily living within them? Whether she obeys me or not is of little import. But I do worry about her ability to command her situation, rather than letting her impulses command her. How do you change this, if it is? An excellent question. Yasna searched through the papers on her small table. She'd been collecting reports from her informants in the war camps, the ones who had survived, about Shallan. She'd truly done well in Yasna's absence. Perhaps what the child needed was not more structure, but more challenges. "All 10 orders are again," Ivory said from behind her. For years it had been only the two of them, Jasnah and Ivory. Ivory had been dodgy about giving odds on whether the other sapient Spren would refound their orders or not. However, he'd always said that he was certain that the Honor Spren, and therefore the Windrunners, would never return. Their attempts to rule Shadesmar had apparently not endeared them to the other races. 10 orders, Jasnah said. All ended in death. All but one, Ivory agreed. They lived in death instead. She turned around, and he met her eyes with his own. No pupils, just oil shimmering above something deeply black. We must tell the others what we learned from Wit, Ivory. Eventually this secret must be known. Jasnah, no! It would be the end. Another recreance. The truth has not destroyed me. You are special. No knowledge is that can destroy you, but the others. She held his eyes, then gathered the sheets stacked beside her. We shall see, she said, then carried them to the table to bind them into a book.
48. Rhythm of Work. But we stand in the sea, pleased with our domains. Leave us alone. Moash grunted as he crossed the uneven ground, hauling a thick, knotted cord over his shoulder. Turned out the Voidbringers had run out of wagons. Too many supplies to bring and not enough vehicles. At least, vehicles with wheels. Moash had been assigned to a sledge, a cart with broken wheels that had been repurposed with a pair of long steel skids. They'd put him first in the line, pulling their rope. The Parshman overseers had considered him the most enthusiastic. Why wouldn't he be? The caravans moved at the slow pace of the Chulls, which pulled roughly half the ordinary wagons. He had sturdy boots and even a pair of gloves. Compared to bridge duty, this was a paradise. The scenery was even better. Central Alethkar was far more fertile than the shattered plains, and the ground sprouted with rock buds and the gnarled roots of trees. The sledge bounced and crunched over these, but at least he didn't have to carry the thing on his shoulders. Around him, hundreds of men pulled wagons or sledges piled high with foodstuffs, freshly cut lumber, or leather made from hog's hide or eel's skin. Some of the workers had collapsed on their first day out of Revelar. The Voidbringers had separated these into two groups. The ones who had tried, but were genuinely too weak, had been sent back to the city. A few deemed to be faking had been whipped, then moved to sledges instead of wagons. Harsh, but fair. Indeed, as the march continued, Moash was surprised at how well the human workers were treated. Though strict and unforgiving, the Voidbringers understood that to work hard, slaves needed good rations and plenty of time at night to rest. They weren't even chained up. Running away would be pointless under the watchful care of Fused who could fly. Moash found himself enjoying these weeks hiking and pulling his sledge. It exhausted his body, quieted his thoughts, and let him fall into a calm rhythm. This was certainly far better than his days as a Light Eyes when he'd worried incessantly about the plot against the king. It felt good just to be told what to do. What happened at the Shattered Plains wasn't my fault, he thought as he hauled the sledge. I was pushed into it. I can't be blamed. These thoughts comforted him. Unfortunately, he couldn't ignore their apparent destination. He'd walked this path dozens of times, running caravans with his uncle, even when he'd been a youth. Across the river, straight southeast. Over Ishar's field and cutting past the town of Inkwell. The Voidbringers were marching to take Kolinar. The caravan included tens of thousands of Parshmen armed with axes or spears. They wore what Moash now knew was called war form, a Parshmen form with carapace armor and a strong physique. They weren't experienced, watching their nightly training told them they were basically the equivalent of Dark Eyes scrounged from villages and pressed into the army. But they were learning, and they had access to the fused. Those zipped through the air or strode along beside carts, powerful and imperious, and surrounded by dark energy. There seemed to be different varieties, but each was intimidating. Everything was converging on the capital. Should that bother him? After all, what had Kolinar ever done for him? It was the place where his grandparents had been left to die, cold and alone in a prison cell. It was where the blighted King Elokar had danced and connived while good people rotted. Did humankind even deserve this kingdom? During his youth, he'd listened to traveling ardents who accompanied the caravans. He knew that long ago humankind had won. A Hariatiam, the final confrontation with the Voidbringers, had happened thousands of years ago. What had they done with that victory? They'd set up false gods in the form of men whose eyes reminded them of the Night's Radiant. The life of men over the centuries had been nothing more than a long string of murders, wars, and thefts. The Voidbringers had obviously returned because men had proven they couldn't govern themselves. That was why the Almighty had sent this scourge. Indeed, the more he marched, the more Moash admired the Voidbringers. The armies were efficient, and the troops learned quickly. The caravans were well supplied. When an overseer saw that Moash's boots were looking worn, he had a new pair by evening. Each wagon or sledge was given 2 parchment overseers, but these were told to use their whips sparingly. They were quietly trained for the position, and Moash heard the occasional conversation between an overseer, once a parchment slave, and an unseen spren who gave them directions. The Voidbringers were smart, driven, and efficient. If Kolinar fell to this force, it would be no more than humankind deserved. Yes, perhaps the time for his people had passed. Moash had failed Kaladin and the others, but that was merely how men were in this debased age. He couldn't be blamed. He was a product of his culture. Only one oddity marred his observations. The Voidbringers seemed so much better than the human armies he'd been part of, except for one thing. There was a group of parchment slaves. They pulled one of the sledges and always walked apart from the humans. They wore work form, not war form, though otherwise they looked exactly like the other parchmen, with the same marbled skin. Why did this group pull a sledge? At first, as Moash plodded across the endless plains of central Alethkar, he found the sight of them encouraging. It suggested that the Voidbringers could be egalitarian. Maybe there'd simply been too few men with the strength to pull these sledges. Yet if that were so, why were these parchmen sledge pullers treated so poorly? The overseers did little to hide their disgust and were allowed to whip the poor creatures without restriction. Moash rarely glanced in their direction without finding one of them being beaten, yelled at, or abused. Moash's heart wrenched to see and hear this. Everyone else seemed to work so well together. Everything else about the army seemed so perfect. Except this. Who were these poor souls? The overseer called a break, and Moash dropped his rope, then took a long pull on his water skin. It was their 21st day of marching, which he only knew because some of the other slaves kept track. He judged the location as several days past Inkwell, in the final stretch toward Kolinar. He ignored the other slaves and settled down in the shade of the sledge, which was piled high with cut timber. Not far behind them, a village burned. There hadn't been anyone in it, as word had run before them. Why had the Voidbringers burned it, but not others they'd passed? Perhaps it was to send a message. Indeed, that smoke trail was ominous. Or perhaps it was to prevent any potential flanking armies from using the village. As his crew waited, Moash didn't know their names and hadn't bothered to ask. The parchment crew trudged past, bloodied and whipped, their overseers yelling them onward. They'd lagged behind. Pervasive cruel treatment led to a tired crew, which in turn led them to being forced to march to catch up when everyone else got a water break. That, of course, only wore them out and caused injuries, which made them lag farther behind, which made them get whipped. That's what happened to Bridge 4 back before Kaladin, Moash thought. Everyone said we were unlucky, but it was just a self-perpetuating downward spiral. Once that crew passed, trailing a few exhaustion spren, one of Moash's overseers called for his team to take up their ropes and get moving again. She was a young Parsh woman with dark red skin, marbled only slightly with white. She wore a hava. Though it didn't seem like marching clothing, she wore it well. She had even done up the sleeve to cover her safe hand.
"What'd they do, anyway?" he said as he took up his rope.
"What was that?" she asked, looking back at him. Storms. Save for that skin and the odd sing-song quality to her voice, she could have been a pretty Makabaki caravan girl.
"That Parshman crew," he said. "What do they do to deserve such rough treatment?"
He didn't actually expect an answer, but the Parsh woman followed his gaze, then shook her head.
"They harbored the false god, brought him into the very center among us."
"The Almighty?" She laughed.
"A real false god, a living one, like our living gods."
She looked up as one of the fused passed overhead.
"There are lots who think the Almighty is real," Moash said. "If that's the case, why are you pulling a sledge?"
She snapped her fingers, pointing. Moash picked up his rope, joining the other men in a double line. They merged with the enormous column of marching feet, scraping sledges and rattling wheels. The Parshendi wanted to arrive at the next town before an impending storm. They'd weathered both types, High Storm and Everstorm, sheltering in villages along the way. Moash fell into the steady rhythm of the work. It wasn't long until he was sweating. He'd grown accustomed to the colder weather in the east near the Frostlands. It was strange to be in a place where the sun felt hot on his skin, and now the weather here was turning toward summer. His sledge soon caught up to the Parshman crew. The two sledges walked side by side for a time, and Moash liked to think that keeping pace with his crew could motivate the poor Parshman. Then one of them slipped and fell, and the entire team lurched to a stop. The whipping began. The cries, the crack of leather on skin.
"That's enough."
Moash dropped his rope and stepped out of the line. His shocked overseers called after him but didn't follow. Perhaps they were too surprised. He strode up to the Parshman sledge where the slaves were struggling to pull themselves back up and start again. Several had bloodied faces and backs. The large Parshman who had slipped lay curled on the ground. His feet were bleeding. No wonder he'd had trouble walking. Two overseers were whipping him. Moash seized one by the shoulder and pushed him back.
"Stop it!" he snapped, then shoved the other overseer aside. "Don't you see what you're doing? You're becoming like us!"
The two overseers stared at him, dumbfounded.
"You can't abuse each other," Moash said. "You can't!"
He turned toward the fallen Parshman and extended a hand to help him up. But from the corner of his eye, he saw one of the overseers raise his arm. Moash spun and caught the whip that cracked at him, snatching it from the air and twisting it around his wrist to gain leverage. Then he yanked it, pulling the overseer stumbling toward him. Moash smashed a fist into his face, slamming him backward to the ground.
"Storms, that hurt!"
He shook his hand, which had clipped carapace on the side as he'd connected. He glared at the other overseer, who yelped and dropped his whip, jumping backward. Moash nodded once, then took the fallen slave by the arm and pulled him upright.
"Ride in the sledge. Heal those feet."
He took the Parshman slave's place in line and pulled the rope taut over his shoulder. By now, his own overseers had gathered their wits and chased after him. They conferred with the two that he'd confronted, one nursing a bleeding cut around his eye. Their conversation was hushed, urgent, and punctuated by intimidated glances toward him. Finally, they decided to let it be. Moash pulled the sledge with the Parshman, and they found someone to replace him on the other sledge. For a while, he thought more would come of it. He even saw one of the overseers conferring with a fused. But they didn't punish him. No one dared to again raise a whip against the Parshman crew the rest of the march.
49. Born unto Light. 23 years ago.
Dalinar pressed his fingers together,
then rubbed them, scraping the dry red-brown moss against itself. The scratchy sound was unpleasantly similar to that of a knife along bone. He felt the warmth immediately like an ember. A thin plume of smoke rose from his calloused fingers and struck below his nose, then parted around his face. Everything faded. The raucous sound of too many men in one room, the musky smell of their bodies pressed together. Euphoria spread through him like sudden sunlight on a cloudy day. He released a protracted sigh. He didn't even mind when Bashan accidentally elbowed him. Most places, being High Prince, would have won him a bubble of space, but at the stained wooden table in this poorly lit den, social standing was irrelevant. Here, with a good drink and a little help pressed between his fingers, he could finally relax. Here, nobody cared how presentable he was or if he drank too much. Here, he didn't have to listen to reports of rebellion and imagine himself out on those fields solving problems the direct way, sword in hand, thrill in his heart. He rubbed the moss more vigorously. "Don't think about war, just live in the moment," as Evie always said. Havar returned with drinks. The lean, bearded man studied the overcrowded bench, then set the drinks down and hauled a slumped drunk out of his spot. He squeezed in beside Bashan. Havar was light-eyed, good family, too. He'd been one of Dalinar's elites back when that had meant something, though now he had his own land and a high commission. He was one of the few who didn't salute Dalinar so hard you could hear it. Bashan, though. Well, Bashan was an odd one. Dark-eyed of the first none, the portly man had traveled half the world and encouraged Dalinar to go with him to see the other half. He still wore that stupid wide-brimmed floppy hat. Havar grunted, passing down the drinks.
"Squeezing in beside you, Bashan, would be far easier if you didn't have a gut that stretched to next week."
"Just trying to do my duty, Bright Lord."
"Your duty?
Light eyes need folks to obey them, right? I'm making certain that you got lots to serve you, at least by weight."
Dalinar took his mug but didn't drink. For now, the fire moss was doing its job. His wasn't the only plume rising in the dim stone chamber. Gavilar hated the stuff, but then Gavilar liked his life now. In the center of the dim room, a pair of parshmen pushed tables aside, then started setting diamond chips on the floor. Men backed away, making space for a large ring of light. A couple of shirtless men pushed their way through the crowd. The room's general air of clumsy conversation turned to one of roaring excitement.
"Are we going to bet?" Havar asked.
"Sure," Bashan replied. "I'll put these three garnet marks on the shorter one."
"I'll take that bet," Havar said, "but not for the money. If I win, I want your hat."
"Deal. Ha! So you're finally going to admit how dashing it is?"
"Dashing? Storms, Bashan. I'm going to do you a favor and burn the thing."
Dalinar sat back, mind dulled by the fire moss.
"Burn my hat," Bashan said. "Storms, Havar. That's harsh. Just because you envy my dashing profile.
The only thing dashing about that hat is how it makes women run the other way.
It's exotic. From the West. Everyone knows fashion comes from the West."
"Yeah. From Leofor and Yezir. Where did you get that hat again?"
"The Pure Lake. Ah, that bastion of culture and fashion. Are you going shopping in Bavland next?" "Barmaids don't know the difference," Bashan grumbled. "Anyway, can we just watch the match? I'm looking forward to winning those marks off you."
He took a drink, but fingered his hat anxiously. Dalinar closed his eyes. He felt as if he could drift off, maybe get some sleep without worrying about Evie or dreaming of war. In the ring, bodies smacked against each other. That sound, the grunts of exertion as the wrestlers tried to push each other from the ring, reminded him of the battle. Dalinar opened his eyes, dropped the moss, and leaned forward. The shorter wrestler danced out of the other's grip. They revolved around one another, crouched, hands at the ready. When they locked again, the shorter man pushed his opponent off balance.
Better stance, Dalinar thought. Kept himself low. A taller fellow has gotten by too long on his strength and size. He's got terrible form.
The two strained, backing toward the edge of the ring before the taller man managed to trip them both. Dalinar stood up as others ahead of him raised their hands and cheered.
The contest. The fight. That led me to almost kill Gavilar.
Dalinar sat back down. The shorter man won. Havar sighed, but rolled a few glowing spheres to Bashan.
Double or nothing on the next bout?
Nah, Bashan said, hefting the marks. It should be enough.
For what?
To bribe a few influential young dandies into trying hats like mine, Bashan said. I tell you, once word gets out, everyone is going to be wearing them.
You're an idiot.
So long as I'm a fashionable one.
Dalinar reached to the floor and picked up the fire moss. He tossed it onto the table and stared at it, then took a pull from his mug of wine. The next wrestling match started, and he winced as the two competitors collided. Storms, why did he keep putting himself into situations like this?
Dalinar, Havar said. Any word yet on when we're going to the rift?
The rift? Bashan asked. What about it?
Are you dense? Havar said.
No, Bashan said. But I might be drunk. What's up with the rift?
Rumor is they want to set up their own high prince, Havar said. Son of the old one. What was his name?
Tanalon, Dalinar said. But we're not going to be visiting the rift, Havar.
Surely the king can't...
We won't be going, Dalinar said. You've got men to train, and I...
Dalinar drank more wine.
I'm going to be a father. My brother can handle the rift with diplomacy.
Havar leaned back, flippantly dropping his mug to the table.
The king can't politic his way past open rebellion, Dalinar.
Dalinar closed his fist around the fire moss, but didn't rub it. How much of his interest in the rift was his duty to protect Gavilar's kingdom, and how much was his craving to feel the thrill again?
Damnation.
He felt like half a man these days. One of the wrestlers had shoved the other from the ring, disturbing the line of lights. The loser was declared, and a parchment carefully reset the ring. As he did so, a master servant stepped up to Dalinar's table.
"Pardon, Bright Lord," he whispered. "But you should know, the feature match will have to be cancelled."
"What?"
Bashan said.
"What's wrong? Mach isn't going to fight?"
"Pardon," the master servant repeated, "but his opponent has stomach problems. The match must be cancelled."
Apparently, news was spreading through the room. The crowd manifested their disapproval with boos and curses, shouts, and spilled drinks. A tall, bald man stood at the side of the ring, bare-chested. He argued with several of the light-eyed organizers, pointing at the ring, anger spren boiling on the floor around him. To Dalinar, this racket sounded like the calls of battle. He closed his eyes and breathed it in, finding a euphoria far superior to the fire moss.
Storms. He should have gotten drunker. He was going to slip.
Might as well be quick about it, then. He tossed aside the fire moss and stood, then pulled off his shirt.
"Dalinar,"
Havar said.
"What are you doing?"
"Gavilar says I need to have more concern for our people's sorrows," Dalinar said, stepping up onto the table. "Seems like we've got a room full of sorrow here."
Havar gaped, jaw dropping.
"Bet on me," Dalinar said, "for old time's sake."
He leaped off the table on the other side, then shoved through the crowd.
"Someone tell that man he has a challenger."
Silence spread from him like a bad smell. Dalinar found himself at the edge of the ring in a completely quiet room, packed with once rowdy men, both light-eyed and dark. The wrestler, Mach, stepped back, his dark green eyes wide, anger spren vanishing. He had a powerful build, arms that bulged like they were overstuffed. Word was he'd never been defeated.
Well, Dalinar said, you wanted a fight, and I need a workout.
Bright Lord, the man said, this was to be a freeform bout. All hits and holds allowed.
Excellent, Dalinar said.
What? You worried about injuring your high prince? I promise you clemency for anything done to me.
Hurting you? The man said.
Storms, that's not what I'm afraid of.
He shivered visibly, and a Thalen woman, perhaps his manager, smacked him on the arm. She thought he'd been rude. The wrestler only bowed and backed away. Dalinar turned about the room, confronted by a sea of faces that suddenly seemed very uncomfortable. He'd broken some kind of rule here. The gathering dissolved, Parshman retrieving spheres from the ground. It seemed Dalinar had been too hasty to judge rank unimportant here. They'd suffered him as an observer, but he was not to participate.
Damnation!
He growled softly as he stalked to his bench, those anger spren following him on the floor. He took his shirt from Bashan with a swipe of the hand. Back with his elites, any man, from the lowest spearmen to the highest captains, would have sparred or wrestled with him. Storms he'd faced the cook several times, much to the amusement of everyone involved. He sat down and pulled on his shirt, stewing. He'd ripped the buttons free in removing it so quickly. The room fell silent as people continued to leave, and Dalinar just sat there, tense, his body still expecting the fight that would never come. No thrill. Nothing to fill him. Soon he and his friends were alone in the room, surveying empty tables, abandoned cups, and spilled drinks. The place somehow smelled even worse now than it had when crowded with men.
"Probably for the best, Bright Lord," Havar said.
"I want to be among soldiers again, Havar," Dalinar whispered. "I want to be marching again. Best sleep a man can get is after a long march. And damnation, I want to fight. I want to face someone who won't pull their punches because I'm a high prince."
"Then let's find such a fight, Dalinar," Havar said. "Surely the king will let us go. If not to the Rift, then to Herdaz or one of the Isles. We can bring him land, glory, honor."
"That wrestler," Dalinar said. "There was something to his words. He was certain I would hurt him."
Dalinar drummed his fingers on the table.
"Was he scared off because of my reputation in general, or is there something more specific?"
Bashan and Havar shared a look.
"When?"
Dalinar asked.
"Tavern fight," Havar said. 2 weeks back. Do you remember it?"
Dalinar remembered a haze of monotony broken by light, a burst of color in his life. Emotion. He breathed out.
"You told me everyone was fine."
"They lived," Havar said.
"One of the brawlers you fought will never walk," Bashan admitted. "Another had to have his arm removed. A third babbles like a child. His brain doesn't work anymore." "That's far from fine," Dalinar snapped.
"Pardon, Dalinar," Havar said. "But when facing the Blackthorn, that's as good as one can expect."
Dalinar crossed his arms on the table, grinding his teeth. The fire moss wasn't working. Yes, it gave him a quick rush of euphoria, but that only made him want the greater headiness of the thrill. Even now, he felt on edge. He had the urge to smash this table and everything in the room. He'd been so ready for the fight. He'd surrendered to the temptation, and then had the pleasure stolen from him. He felt all the shame of losing control, but none of the satisfaction of actually getting to fight. Dalinar seized his mug, but it was empty. Stormfather. He threw it and stood up, wanting to scream. He was fortunately distracted by the back door to the wrestling den, inching open, revealing a familiar pale face. Toe wore Alethi clothing now, one of the new suits that Gavilar preferred, but it fit him poorly. He was too spindly. No man would ever mistake Toe, with that overcautious gait and wide-eyed innocence, for a soldier.
"Dalinar?"
he asked,
looking over the spilled drinks and the locked sphere lamps on the walls.
The guards said I could find you here. Was this a party?
Ah, Toe, Habar said, lounging back in his seat. How could it have been a party without you?
Toe's eyes flicked toward the chunk of fire moss on the ground nearby.
I'll never understand what you see in these places, Dalinar.
He's just getting to know the common people, Bright Lord, Bashan said, pocketing the fire moss. You know us dark-eyed types, always wallowing in depravity. We need good role models, too.
He cut off as Dalinar raised his hand. He didn't need underlings to cover for him.
What is it, Toe?
Oh, the Rearin man said. They were going to send a messenger, but I wanted to deliver the news. My sister, you see. It's a little early, but the midwives aren't surprised. They say it's natural when...
Dalinar gasped, like he'd been punched in the stomach. Early, midwives, sister. He charged for the door and didn't hear the rest of what Toe said. Evie looked like she'd fought in a battle. He'd seen that expression on the faces of soldiers many times. That sweaty brow, that half-dazed, drowsy look. Exhaustion spread like jets in the air. These were the mark of a person pushed past the limits of what they thought they could do. She bore a smile of quiet satisfaction, a look of victory. Dalinar pushed past doting surgeons and midwives, stepping up to Evie's bed. She held out a limp hand, her left hand, which was wrapped only in a thin envelope that ended at the wrist. It would have been a sign of intimacy to an Aleti, but Evie still preferred that hand.
"The baby?"
he whispered, taking the hand.
"A son. Healthy and strong."
"A son? I have a son?"
Dalinar dropped to his knees beside the bed.
"Where is he?"
"Being washed, my lord," said one of the midwives. "He will be returned shortly."
"Torn buttons," Evie whispered. "You've been fighting again, Dalinar?"
"Just a small diversion."
"That's what you say each time."
Dalinar squeezed her hand through the envelope, too elated to prickle at the chastisement.
"You and Toe came here to Alethkar because you wanted someone to protect you. You sought out a fighter, Evie."
She squeezed his hand back. A nurse approached with a bundle in her arms, and Dalinar looked up, stunned, unable to rise.
"Now," the woman said, "many men are apprehensive at first when..."
She cut off as Dalinar found his strength and seized the child from her arms. He held the boy aloft in both hands, letting out a whooping laugh, glory spren bursting around him as golden spears.
"My son," he said.
"My lord," the nurse said, "be careful."
"He's a Kolin," Dalinar said, cradling the child. "He's made of hardy stuff."
He looked down at the boy, who, red-faced, wiggled and thrashed with his tiny fists. He had shockingly thick hair, black and blonde mixed. Good coloring. Distinctive.
"May you have your father's strength," Dalinar thought, rubbing the child's face with his finger. "And at least some of your mother's compassion, little one."
Looking into that face, swelling with joy, Dalinar finally understood. This was why Gavilar thought so much about the future, about Alethkar, about crafting a kingdom that would last. Dalinar's life so far had stained him crimson and thrashed his soul. His heart was so crusted over with Krem it might as well have been a stone. But this boy, he could rule the princedom, support his cousin the king, and live a life of honor.
"His name, Bright Lord?"
asked Ishal, an aged ardent from the Devatory of Purity.
"I would burn the proper glyph wards if it pleases you."
"Name," Dalinar said. "Eduda."
"Light." He glanced toward Evie, who nodded in agreement.
"Without a suffix, my lord? Edodan? Edodal?"
"Lin,"
Dalinar whispered. "Born unto. Adolin." a good name, traditional, full of meaning. With regret, Dalinar surrendered the child to the nurses, who returned him to his mother, explaining that it was important to train the baby to suckle as soon as possible. Most in the room began to file out to offer privacy, and as they did, Dalinar caught sight of a regal figure standing at the back. How had he missed Gavilar there? Gavilar took him by the arm and gave him a good thump on the back as they left the chamber. Dalinar was so dazed he barely felt it. He needed to celebrate, buy drinks for every man in the army, declare a holiday, or just run through the city whooping for joy. He was a father.
"An excellent day," Gavilar said. "A most excellent day."
"How do you contain it?" Dalinar said.
"This excitement."
Gavilar grinned.
"I let the emotion be my reward for the work I have done."
Dalinar nodded, then studied his brother.
"What?" Dalinar said. "Something is wrong."
"Nothing."
"Don't lie to me, brother.
I don't want to ruin your wonderful day."
"Wondering will ruin it more than anything you could say, Gavilar. Out with it."
The king mulled, then nodded toward Dalinar's den. They crossed the main chamber, passing furniture that was far too showy, colorful with floral patterns and plush cushions. Evie's taste was partially to blame, though it was also just life these days. His life was plush. The den was more to his liking. A few chairs, a hearth, a simple rug.
A cabinet with various exotic and potent wines, each in a distinctive bottle.
They were the type it was almost ashamed to drink, as it spoiled the display.
"It's your daughter," Dalinar guessed. "Her lunacy."
"Yasna is fine and recovering."
"It's not that."
Gavilar frowned, his expression dangerous. He'd agreed to a crown, after much debate. Sunmaker hadn't worn one, and the history said Ysera Elin refused them as well. But people did love symbols, and most Western kings wore crowns. Gavilar had settled upon a black iron circlet. The more Gavilar's hair grayed, the easier the crown was to see. A servant had set a fire in the hearth, though it was burning low, only a single flame spren crawling along the embers.
"I am failing," Gavilar said.
"What?"
"Rathalas, the rift."
"But I thought..."
"Propaganda," Gavilar said. "Intended to quiet critical voices in Kolinar. Tanalan is raising an army and settling into his fortifications. Worse, I think the other high princes are encouraging him. They want to see how I handle this."
He sneered.
"There's talk I've grown soft over the years."
"They're wrong."
Dalinar had seen it, these months living with Gavilar. His brother had not grown soft. He was still as eager for conquest as ever. He simply approached it differently. The clash of words, the maneuvering of princedoms into positions where they were forced to obey. The fire's embers seemed to pulse like a heartbeat.
"Do you ever wonder about the time when this kingdom was truly great, Dalinar?"
Gavilar asked.
"When people looked to the Aleti? When kings sought their advice? When we were... radiant?"
"Traitors," Dalinar said.
"Does the act of a single generation negate many generations of domination? We revere the Sunmaker when his reign lasted but the blink of an eye. Yet we ignore the centuries the Radiance led. How many desolations did they defend mankind?"
The Ardents talked about this in prayers, didn't they? He tried to guess.
10?
"A meaningless number," Gavilar said, waving his fingers. "The histories just say 10 because it sounds significant. Either way, I have failed in my diplomatic efforts."
He turned toward Dalinar. "It is time to show the kingdom that we are not soft, brother."
"Oh, no."
Hours ago, he would have leaped in excitement, but after seeing that child...
"You'll be anxious again in a few days," Dalinar told himself. "A man can't change in a moment."
Gavilar, he whispered. I'm worried. You're still the Black Thorn, Dalinar. I'm not worried about whether I can win battles. Dalinar stood, throwing back his chair in his haste. He found himself pacing. I'm like an animal, Gavilar. Did you hear about the bar fight? Storms, I can't be trusted around people. You are what the Almighty made you. I'm telling you, I'm dangerous. Sure, I can crush this little rebellion, bathe Oathbringer in some blood. Great, wonderful. Then what? I come back here and lock myself in a cage again?
I might have something that will help.
Bah. I've tried living a quiet life. I can't live through endless politics like you can. I need more than just words.
You've merely been trying to restrain yourself. You've tried casting out the bloodthirst, but you haven't replaced it with anything else. Go do what I command, then return and we can discuss further.
Dalinar stopped near his brother, then took a single purposeful step into his shadow.
Remember this. Remember you serve him.
He would never return to that place that had almost led him to attack this man.
When do I ride for the rift? Dalinar asked. You don't. But you just said,
I'm sending you to battle, but not against the rift. Our kingdom suffers threats from abroad. There is a new dynasty threatening us from Herdaz. A Reshi house has gained power there, and the Vaidens have been raiding Alethkar in the southwest. They're claiming it's bandits, but the forces are too organized. It's a test to see how we react.
Dalinar nodded slowly.
You want me to go fight on our borders? Remind everyone we're still capable of employing the sword.
Exactly. This is a dangerous time for us, brother. The High Prince's question. Is a united Alethkar worth the trouble? Why bow before a king?
Tanalan is the manifestation of their questions, but he has been careful not to stray into outright rebellion.
If you attack him, the other High Princes could unite behind the rebels. We could shatter the kingdom and have to start all over. I will not allow that. I will have a unified Alethkar. Even if I have to hit the High Princes so hard they are forced to melt together from the heat of it. They need to remember that. Go to Herdaz first, then Yakaved. Remind everyone why they fear you.
Gavilar met Dalinar's eyes. No, he was not soft. He thought like a king now. He sought the long term, but Gavilar Kholin was as determined as ever.
It will be done, Dalinar said. Storms this day had been a tempest of emotion.
Dalinar stalked toward the door. He wanted to see the child again.
Brother, Gavilar said.
Dalinar turned back and regarded Gavilar, who was bathed by the bleeding light of a fire reaching its end.
Words are important, Gavilar said. Much more than you give them credit for being.
Perhaps, Dalinar said.
But if they were all-powerful, you wouldn't need my sword, would you? Perhaps. I can't help feeling words would be enough. If only I knew the right ones to say.
50. Shash 37. We also instruct that you should not return to Obra Dei. We have claimed that world, and a new avatar of our being is beginning to manifest there. She is young yet, and, as a precaution, she has been instilled with an intense and overpowering dislike of you. To Dalinar, flying felt much like being on a ship in the ocean. There was something profoundly disconcerting about being out on the ocean, subject to the winds and currents. Men didn't control the waves, they merely set out and prayed that the ocean didn't decide to consume them. Flying alongside Captain Kaladin provoked some of the same emotions in Dalinar. On one hand, the view over the shattered plains was magnificent. He felt he could almost see the pattern to it that Shallan mentioned. On the other hand, this kind of travel was deeply unnatural. Winds buffeted them,
and if you moved your hands or arched your back in the wrong way, you were sent in a different direction from everyone else. Kaladin had to constantly zip back and forth, righting one of them that got blown off course. And if you looked down, and paused to consider exactly how high up you were? Well, Dalinar was not a timid man, but he was still glad of Navani's hand in his. On his other side flew Elikar, and beyond him were Kadash and a pretty young Ardent who served as one of Navani's scholars. The five of them were escorted by Kaladin and 10 of his squires. The Windrunners had been training steadily for 3 weeks now, and Kaladin had finally, after practicing by flying groups of soldiers back and forth to the war camps, agreed to treat Dalinar and the king to a similar trip.
"It is like being on a ship," Dalinar thought.
What would it feel like to be up here during a high storm? That was how Kaladin planned to get Elikar's team to Kolinar, fly them at the leading edge of a storm so his stormlight was continually renewed.
"You're thinking of me," the Stormfather said. "I can feel it." "I'm thinking of how you treat ships," Dalinar whispered, his physical voice lost to the winds, yet his meaning carried unhampered to the Stormfather. "Men should not be upon the waters during a storm," he replied. "Men are not of the waves." "And the sky? Are men of the sky?" "Some are."
He said this grudgingly. Dalinar could only imagine how terrible it must be to be a sailor out at sea during a storm. He had taken only short coastwise trips by ship.
"No, wait," he thought. "There was one, of course. A trip to the valley."
He barely remembered that voyage, though he could not blame that solely upon the Night Watcher. Captain Kaladin swooped over. He was the only one who seemed truly in control of his flying. Even his men flew more like dropped rocks than sky eels. They lacked his finesse, his control. Though the others could help if something went wrong, Kaladin had been the only one lashing Dalinar and the others. He said he wanted practice for the eventual flight to Kolinar. Kaladin touched Elokar, and the king started to slow. Kaladin then moved down the line, slowing each in turn. He then swept them up so they were close enough to speak. His soldiers stopped and floated nearby.
"What's wrong?"
Dalinar asked, trying to ignore that he was hanging hundreds of feet in the sky.
"Nothing's wrong," Kaladin said, then pointed.
With the wind in his eyes, Dalinar had failed to spot the war camps. 10 crater-like circles arrayed along the northwestern edge of the shattered plains. From up here, it was obvious they had once been domes, the way their walls curved, like cupping fingers from underneath. 2 of the war camps were still fully occupied, and Sabariel had set up forces to lay claim to the nearby forest. Dalinar's own war camp was less populated, but had a few platoons of soldiers and some workers.
"We arrived so quickly," Navani said.
Her hair was a wind-tousled mess, much of it having escaped her careful braid. Elikar hadn't fared much better. His hair sprayed out from his face like waxed Thalen eyebrows. The 2 Ardents, of course, were bald and didn't have such worries.
"Quick indeed," Elikar said, redoing a few buttons of his uniform. "This is most promising for our mission."
"Yeah," Kaladin said. "I still want to test it more in front of a storm."
He took the king by the shoulder, and Elikar started to drift downward. Kaladin sent them each down in turn, and when his feet finally touched stone again, Dalinar heaved a sigh of relief. They were only one plateau over from the war camp, where a soldier at a watchpost waved to them with eager, exaggerated movements. Within minutes, a troop of Kolin soldiers had surrounded them.
"Let's get you inside the walls, Bright Lord," their captain lord said, hand on the pommel of his sword. "The shell heads are still active out here."
"Have they attacked this close to the camps?" Elikar asked, surprised.
"No, but that doesn't mean they won't, Your Majesty."
Dalinar wasn't so worried, but said nothing as the soldiers ushered him and the others into the war camp where Brightness Yasalai, the tall, stately woman Dalinar had put in charge of the camp, met and accompanied them. After spending so much time in the alien hallways of Yuvathiru,
Walking through this place, which had been Dalinar's home for 5 years, was relaxing. Part of that was finding the war camp mostly intact. It had weathered the Everstorm quite well. Most of the buildings were stone bunkers, and that western rim of the former dome had provided a solid windbreak.
"My only worry," he told Yasalai after a short tour, "is about logistics. This is a long march from Narak and the Oathgate. I fear that by dividing our forces among Narak, here, and Urethiru, we're increasing our vulnerability to an attack."
"That is true, Bright Lord," the woman said. "I endeavor only to provide you with options."
Unfortunately, they would probably need this place for farming operations, not to mention the lumber. Plateau runs for gem hearts couldn't sustain the tower's city population forever, particularly in the face of Shallan's assessment that they had likely hunted chasm fiends near to extinction. Dalinar glanced at Navani. She thought they should found a new kingdom here, on and around the Shattered Plains.